Tim and Sid. So funny, you might pee a little. Luckily, you can listen on the can. Subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. This is Good Show with Edison Bunkus.
This one's good!
On Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
One o'clock, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. This is Good Show. No Ben Ennis, no J.D. Bunkus the rest of the week. They're back next week from vacation. Are they both back next week? All right, that's good. They took vacation simultaneously, too. That's nice. Are they vacationing together? No, they're not doing that. I don't blame it. I'd want to get the hell away from each other, too, for at least 1 week. My name is George Russick, alongside former Blue Jays first base coach Tim Leaper. Leap, I'm excited to be doing this show with you for 3 hours today. I'm looking forward to it.
It's great. I'm looking at the guest list. I'm looking at all the stuff we got to talk about. I have a feeling it's going to go really quick.
Yeah, we got lots to talk about. Keegan Mathison, reporter for MLB.com, is going to join us straight ahead. Jays picked up a nice 10-4 victory over the Red Sox last night. Teoscar Hernandez looked good. Aaron Sanchez gets the start. Bo Bichette had some interesting things to say to David Singh of Sportsnet as well. We'll dive head first into all of that. Glenn Grunwald, president and CEO of Canada Basketball, former Raptors general manager. The list of invitees for the training camp for the senior national men's team ahead of the FIBA World Cup. We'll talk to him about that as well. And we have to ask him about what's up with Andrew Wiggins. Why? We'll ease into that, too. We can't go right away. So, Glenn, thanks for joining us. Andrew Wiggins, what's up? Like, we can't dive headfirst into the Andrew Wiggins question. We'll massage it into the interview. Like, that's just, hopefully he's not listening. But you're going to get the question, Glenn. We have to ask it. We wouldn't be doing our job if we wouldn't.
You know what's a nice thing, though? You look at their depth now, where it was like 5 years ago, this would have been fatal. And we deal with this with baseball Canada all the time. We lose a big player for the WBC, and it's hard to get depth, and a depth starter or a depth good player to come up and help us win, but they're in a much better position today than they've ever been.
No question.
Where something like this doesn't affect them as much.
And guys keep coming up through the system. Look at RJ Barrett, number 3 pick overall in the NBA draft. He's on the training camp roster as well. Looking forward to seeing him play for Canada. Stanley Johnson, new Toronto Raptors guard, is going to join us. And you have a connection to Stanley Johnson, which is kind of cool.
Very loose connection, but I played in a few tournaments as a young kid with his high school basketball coach at Modern Day. And it was unbelievable. And the guy made a huge impact on me. Like, even though I played just a few tournaments for him, and I was nowhere near the player that Stanley is. But it was it's a kind of an interesting tie-in. When I was reading about him, it was interesting to see, and I'm curious what he has to say about it.
Yeah, looking forward to talking to Stanley Johnson. Jason Sobel, senior golf writer for the Action Network. We're going to help you again if you still haven't filled out your Open Championship pools. We're going to help you with that, who he likes in the tournament as well. And we'll obviously talk about Brooks Koepka, who's in this incredible run of majors, won 4 of the last 8. And his caddy, Ricky Elliott, is a guy who used to be a member at Royal Portrush in Northern Ireland. It has only played, he thinks about 1,500 rounds there. So Koepka is not only the hottest golfer on the planet, he also has his caddy who has ridiculous course knowledge.
There's so many great
subplots. How do you not take him this weekend?
It's hard. It's going to be hard not to. And the course seems to kind of fit his style a little bit, too. And that's going to be a great topic of conversation.
I think every course fits Brooks Koepka's style because he hits it so ridiculously far. Did you hear the quote yesterday saying he doesn't practice?
No.
He doesn't. He alleges that he doesn't practice during the regular PGA Tour. If you see me on TV, that's when I'm golfing. He only practices ahead of the majors.
That just must kill some of those guys when they hear something like that.
You think that's true?
Yeah, I do.
Really?
I actually do. I'm sure he putts in his room or something like that.
You mean with like the old cup and he does the old putt move and he does the putting that way? Jason Bay, former major leaguer and Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame inductee, 3-time All-Star, is going to join us at 3 o'clock. Looking forward to talking to Jason Bay as well. And he can talk about how far Canadian baseball has gone. He's a BC guy, right?
Yes. And interesting, he's got a lot of interesting takes on what it's like to be. He was a young player that was traded quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And he's also a guy that was traded at the deadline. So I think it's kind of fitting that he's here.
I want to ask him as well. We hear all this talk about baseball potentially coming back to Montreal. Why can't we have potentially a team out in Vancouver, out west?
That would be great.
Yeah, your face right now, you're
I
like, did. What?
I just thought about that. I'm signing up.
Yeah, why like Vancouver? Why, that'd be a great rivalry with Seattle.
Yeah, and we have the Canadiens there, listen, which does a great job. There's 8,000 people a night for a short season team.
Leap, you lived it. How many people from Vancouver area go to those Seattle Mariners games? It's like you guys had home games and you were the Blue Jays.
No better thing being a Blue Jay than going out to Seattle.
We'll ask Jason Bay that as well, and we'll talk to Jeff Baker, NHL writer and columnist for the Seattle Times. It looks like they're about to name Ron Francis as the general manager of the yet-to-be-named Seattle expansion NHL franchise. Everybody thinks it's going to be the Totems, I think.
I haven't.
Do you like that name?
It's, you know, is a name ever good when it first comes out? It's always something that kind of grows on you.
Everyone's, I didn't like Golden Knights. I thought Vegas blew a chance to have a really awesome name, but I'm okay with the Golden Knights.
And if you watch their intro, like their intro into the game is like pretty spectacular.
It's so spectacularly cheesy that I just eat it up.
It's Vegas, right?
I absolutely love it. Jays picked up a 10-4 win last night over the Red Sox. Keegan Matheson's a reporter for MLB.com, and he joins us here on Good Show. Keegan, how are you?
Doing very well. How are you doing today?
We're great. Teoscar Hernandez has a big night, comes back up from AAA, and Kevin Barker was talking about this on Baseball Central, and I thought it was really interesting. He's tried a few other things with his swing, and he's kind of reverting back to who he is as a baseball player. Did you kind of see that last night with his swing, that he wasn't trying all those other things? He was trying to stay up here at the major league level?
Yeah, it looks a little more simplified, and there's been some magic in AAA Buffalo this year for a lot of Blue Jays hitters, going down and having an opportunity to get back to themselves or make a bit of an adjustment, because when you're doing that at the major league level and you are facing the best of the best, trying to adjust on the fly is not going to work. And doing what Teoscar has done, just like we've seen Lourdes Gurriel Jr. do before him, getting back to who he is. And Teoscar just needs to put the bat on the ball, hit it in the good part of the bat, and he has enough strength and enough natural power to be that 30 home run guy each year. And we're seeing a little bit more of that now, getting that confidence back, being more aggressive in the counts. And that's good to see for the Blue Jays, because going into the season, Teoscar Hernandez was a guy who was expected to potentially break out a little bit. A lot of praise for his defense as well. Didn't work out early, but better late than never. Now it's looked much better.
Keegan, there's always the talk that if you're going to have Teoscar Hernandez on this team, he's a very similar player to Randal Grichuk. Do you want both of those guys on this team moving forward? Do you want them as building blocks for this team? Are they the same guy? Can these guys both be part of the solution moving forward with the Blue Jays?
Well, certainly similar from a surface level look, in that they're going to give you some power. They're going to make some good plays in the field, and they're going to have some shortcomings there as well. Have some speed in Teoscar Hernandez as well. I think his speed is actually underrated, even though he's not a pure base stealer, a very fast player. But what you want from either Hernandez or Grichuk is some on base. You know, the Blue Jays have a low on base percentage as a team, one of the worst in the majors. And that's where guys like Kevin Biggio can be so valuable for this team right now. They need guys with that 340, 360 on-base percentage. And Hernandez and Grichuk will not be that, but they've at least got to chip in a little bit of that so that the empty at-bats aren't dragging that lineup down. And that's always going to be a challenge for them. Grichuk is always a great second-half player, or at least has been lately, so we'll see how that goes. But if they're both going to be in that lineup, if they're both going to be in that outfield, they better be hitting. They've got to be at least hitting for power and cashing in on what their primary tool is.
Well, what did you think of Wagispak's start? Only went 4 2/3 innings, gave up 6 hits, 4 runs, all earned with 3 walks and 2 strikeouts. It's a tough ballpark to play against the defending World Series champions. What did you think of his start last night?
You know, it's a tall ask for Jacob Wagispak, and it was a great example of what happens when a lineup sees you multiple times through the order. Things very clearly slowed down for him a bit that last time through the order, and Boston knew what to look for. But Jacob Wagispak has a chance to earn some starts down the stretch here for the Blue Jays, especially as we approach the deadline here now, and some more opportunities should be opening up. So to get an arm like him that's young and controllable for a couple of months of Aaron Loop last year is good business. You know, you'd like to see him continue to work through that into the fifth and sixth, but he will probably be given an opportunity to do that and to get over that hump. Maybe he does and can chew through some innings for the Blue Jays, but that was a classic learning example. Really shows you how a young pitcher has to adjust, and they have to kind of throw the first punch, if you will. You can't wait for a championship lineup to catch on to you. You need to make that adjustment first, whether it's location, pitch types, whatever it is, and that's what Wagstaff saw last night.
Hey, Keegan, it's Leap here. Just asking, Bo Bichette had some very interesting things to say last night in the postgame, you know, scrum, I guess. What are your takes on that, and what do you think, like, moving forward here? When do you think possibly he could arrive here in Toronto?
Hey, Leap, good to hear you. I'm glad you joined us on the dark side here. This is great. But, yeah, Bo Bichette, some interesting comments there to David Singh at Sportsnet, and talking about his play so far, how he's checked off those boxes, and Bo Bichette is always going to be the young guy from this group, that Vladdy, Biggio, Pearson group. He's going to be the guy with a bit of edge, and I think a lot of fans will like that, but there will also, you know, be comments like this where he's honest, and you like to see that. So he has really hit all of those boxes that the Blue Jays have put out for him. But like we saw with Vladdy, it's always a question of experience. Is the defense there where the Blue Jays like it enough? It's not just about looking at a stat sheet for all of these guys. If it was, you know, Vladdy would have been even quicker to the majors, but we're seeing why. So that'll be interesting, and I think so much of it has to do with Eric Sogard and Freddie Galvis. If one of those two is moved at the trade deadline, and a contender could certainly use those guys, they've had great years. If one of the two is moved, it becomes much likelier. But otherwise, I think that still is a bit of a difficult path. But Bichette, to his credit, and he said it and he knows it, he has done everything in his power. He's held up his end of the bargain, and I think if he hadn't missed those 6-7 weeks with a broken hand, those counting stats would be even higher now, and that would be an even stronger case, even more noise.
Keegan, and that's a great point about Galvis and Sogard being here. Do you think those guys are here past the trade deadline? Are there any teams in contention that potentially could have a Freddie Galvis or an Eric Sogard coming off the bench as depth for them? Do you see these guys being here past the deadline? And obviously that would open the door for a Bo Bichette to be called up.
I think it is possible that we see one moved potentially, and any contending team would love to have a great glove at shortstop or have a guy like Eric Sogard who's been valuable in the leadoff spot. He's in a hot season. You don't need him to be great for 5 years. You need him to be good for 2, maybe 3 months, ideally. And Sogard is hot, and he's played all around the field, showed a little more versatility, so hello to the NL teams there as well. But if one of those guys are moved, and I think there will be interest, there will be calls, it's just a matter of whether the Blue Jays want to move on from that. Kind of like Justin Smoak, how they really value having a veteran, not just on the field, but in the clubhouse. That's a factor as well, but you're right. That will really open it up, I think, for Bo Bichette if there is a move there.
He's a reporter for MLB.com. Keegan Matheson joining us here on Good Show. It's George Russick. It's Tim Leeper. It's Sportsnet 590 The Fan. You mentioned Vladdy's defense, and I think he surprised a lot of us when he first got called up here. But clearly, it's been a bit of a struggle playing third base this entire year. Clearly, I think the Blue Jays will give him the opportunity to play third base this entire year. But I heard Kevin Barker say something at Baseball Central. I thought it was really interesting. He thinks the third baseman of the Blue Jays in 2020 is not on this roster. Do you agree with that?
You know, I think that Vladdy will be given a long leash there. I expect that will stretch into 2020, maybe even beyond, just given where the window of contention is right now. If the Blue Jays were one game out of a playoff spot, maybe you get a little bit pickier, a little quicker. But I think Vladdy will be given a long leash there. But it's interesting to see the plays he does and doesn't make. You see it with young infielders a lot. Even Richie Urania at shortstop the last couple of years is a bit similar. He'll make the incredible play on a hot liner diving to his left. Great throw across the diamond, great arm. And you think, wow, here this guy is. But then there's a slow roller and he boots it. So it's some of those fundamental plays that you need reps to get in. And Vladdy is not going to be a gold glover, does not need to be. But I at least think that he'll be allowed to kick that can down the road a little bit longer. Of course, first base, you know, given his defensive talent and the body, is probably likelier long term. But I do think he'll be given a bit of a longer leash to try.
Hey, last night's game, the situation was kind of setting up to where it could have been a safe situation. Obviously, the Blue Jays broke it open late, and they didn't need it. But was Giles available last night, or are they shooting more for today?
You know, it's looking like guaranteed today, based on what we're hearing out of Boston there with Ken Giles. And a funny issue coming up with that elbow. Thankfully, it looks like the Blue Jays have avoided anything too serious, because the moment you hear elbow or shoulder, red flags go up. But it sounds like he will be available today. I'm sure we'll have an update probably just in a couple of hours on Ken Giles. But that's big news for the Blue Jays on the field. But, of course, Ken Giles is as hot of a trade chip as you're going to find outside of Marcus Stroman on this roster as well. So having him back healthy and ideally maybe getting in a couple of back-to-back outings, I think, over this next week would be a perfect scenario for the Blue Jays. But it'll definitely be something that we'll be keeping an eye on, not just getting in the game, but those velocity numbers. Where is it? Is it 96.5? Is it 97, 98? Because other teams are going to be watching that very, very closely, I think.
Keegan, obviously, you just mentioned it, the biggest trade chips the Blue Jays have are Stroman and Giles. And we know that it's a hard trade deadline now for the first time in baseball, which I think is really cool at the end of the month. How much can these guys pitch for this team? How much are you risking potential injury? If Giles, you obviously have to show that he's healthy enough to go out there and pitch some innings, but Marcus Stroman as well. How do you limit these guys' innings to kind of showcase them, but you also don't want them to get hurt because ideally they won't be Blue Jays by the end of the month?
That's the big gamble right now. And I think Ken Giles right now is where Stroman was a week ago, where you just need to go out and prove you're good, and then we're fine. Everybody knows who that pitcher is, what he can do. So Ken Giles, with an outing or two, I think will dispel any of those nerves from other teams. But when the Blue Jays are going into this now, what can you gain from putting those guys out there again? Sure, if Marcus Stroman throws two perfect games, maybe that value creeps up a little bit. But it's likelier, if you're taking a pessimist approach, that you're risking an injury or a poor outing. And Blue Jays fans, of course, are viewing these guys through a positive lens. But if you're negotiating, if you're another GM, you're trying to poke holes, you're trying to drive that price down any way possible. And I think that's really all that can happen with more outings, more starts. So the Blue Jays have shown a tendency to wait for deadlines and gather as much as they can. But if there's ever been a time to push it and try to be that first one off the line, if you can find a deal of value, what you're looking for right now, this is probably it.
Aaron Sanchez is getting the start tonight, and he's been struggling this season. And it's not multiple innings. It seems like he has one really bad inning that's just ballooning all his numbers as well. Is there any way the Blue Jays are going to trade Aaron Sanchez by the end of the month? And why would they when his value probably is at its absolute lowest?
Yeah, I think at this point, it really would be pennies on the dollar with Aaron Sanchez. And given that added year of team control that he has, I think that's really important. If Sanchez was entering free agency right now, that would be bad news for everybody involved. Sanchez, the Blue Jays, everyone, Scott Boras included. But given that extra year that he has with the Blue Jays under control, they can either try to rebuild him, get him back as a starter, because Major League Baseball is very much, what have you done for me lately? If he comes back next year, makes 20 good starts, boom, there's that value again. Or the bullpen is always an option as well, because starting, as we've seen all year, has not been working. And you're right, it's always just the one inning. He'll look great through three or four and then slam into a wall. Like we talked about with Wagspack, guys come back and see him for a second or third time. They notice that sinker is not sinking like it did back in 2016 or 17, and they're hitting him. He's not controlling the zone, so a lot of variables there, but I think a trade with Aaron Sanchez right now would be very unlikely and not a lot of ways that could make sense.
Keegan, does Aaron Sanchez feel like if he gets a change of scenery, he can snap back into that guy who won the ERA title?
You know, so much of it for Sanchez right now, I think, is more focused on getting his mechanics back now that he's feeling healthy with that finger, which comes with the asterisk of, you know, we've heard the finger is good five or six times before, and then it wasn't, but sounds like it's good for now. I think it's more about just getting those mechanics back and an actual physical aspect. You know, of course, there's a mental aspect to struggling this much after you were as good as he was, but I don't think a change of scenery can take care of all of this, because you're looking for more velocity. You're looking for more movement on that sinking fastball, getting it in the zone. And that's not something that you can do by changing cities. I think there are still some physical aspects that really need to be taken care of that he and Pete Walker are actively working on, but still waiting to see those results in games.
You know, I think you hit the nail on the head. For me, Sanchez, every time he goes out and he's healthy, is another step closer in the right direction. Do you think that this could almost be a blessing in disguise for a team that's probably really short on starting pitching, and it's definitely a guy who, if he finishes strong and goes into next year, like, not only does it make you a little more deeper as a ball club and keep you in a lot more games and helps the development of your young players, but also it also provides a little bit of a veteran leadership to the younger guys that are coming up. If you happen to bring up a Nate Pearson or the TJ Zoich or whoever else is coming up, can you see that that's a good scenario for the Blue Jays?
Yeah, I think it could work out from there, Leaf. And when you look at where the Blue Jays could be at after a Marcus Stroman trade, that's a really young rotation, you know, especially going into next year, given who's going to be sticking around. The Blue Jays are probably going to continue going young. And it's important, I think, to view Aaron Sanchez through his current context. I know we talk a lot about 2016, but that was a long time ago. And that right now is the outlier for his career. What he's done since has been pretty similar to what we've seen this season. So if you view it at that bar and that context, well, then you're hoping for a bounce back, you know, looking to go back to what he was before, and perhaps there's some value to be reclaimed. But the Blue Jays need somebody to pitch. They need somebody to eat these innings. You know, Ryan Barucki coming back will help a little bit, but having a guy who's at least been around the majors, knows what this is about. I know Aaron Sanchez, a guy that Nate Pearson looks up to and has watched a lot of, so that can only help, but it's going to be a really interesting story next year, trying to rebuild Aaron Sanchez and everyone involved, Sanchez, his agent, the Blue Jays, they all have a big stake in that.
He is a reporter for MLB.com, Keegan Matheson. Keegan, thanks for this, pal.
Appreciate it, guys. Thank you.
There he goes. Keegan Matheson. And Aaron Sanchez is very interesting to me because we don't hear anything definitively, but you were with the organization and the whole issues with the finger. I don't want to put you on the spot, or I don't want you to really out anybody in the organization, but do you think there was a bit of mistrust between how his finger was being handled by the organization and his camp?
I think that's a crazy subject. It's wide open. Guys have been through this before. And then when you're talking about it, something like the finger, where there's not a ton of, you know, history with these things. I mean, there's Al Leiter. There's been cases of it in the past. I don't think anybody really knows. So I think that's kind of like come and gone and that's over with. I think they're definitely on the side now of like, this thing's getting better. We're getting better. And how do we treat it from this part forward? So I think that's really kind of a non-issue right now. I think the most important thing for Aaron, I think the most important thing for the team is to get out there, stay healthy, reclaim what you were, you know, back in 16 and even, even back then. And I said this all last week and I say it now and I truly believe it in my heart. I think every time he goes out there and he's healthy and he finishes his start, it's another step closer to where he needs to be. And watching him against the Yankees the other day, those four innings were great. There was velocity, there was movement, there was good feel on the breaking stuff. I know there was some sickness involved in the fifth inning went south. But, you know, beyond that, if you look at if he makes his starts for the rest of the season and he comes away from her healthy, I think you're going to end up having a really good pitcher. If not by the end of this year, definitely leading into the next season.
Do you think it's more mental or mechanical with him?
I think it's both. I mean, you know, when you're an athlete and you're throwing the ball with your finger, like, and that's the thing that you're thinking about, and it's taken away from your game planning. It's taken away from just your feel, your competitiveness, and you're trying to manipulate your body in ways to, like, alleviate pressure off a finger. There's so many other factors that go involved, that get involved with it, that it can't help but change you and change your mechanics, and it definitely changes your mindset. So, again, being healthy every start, I think it gets him back into the mindset where now he's facing the hitter. He's not worried about how he has to manipulate his body to make the pitch or do anything like that. He's just out there throwing the baseball again. And I'm seeing that from him right now. You're seeing signs of where he's just going out there. He's out there competing, and he's going out there and coming after you, and he's got movement on his heater, which is going to be the key for him.
Now, you were there firsthand when he was blockbuster out of the bullpen. Like, I mean, just pretty much unhittable. And his velocity was just out of control, Aaron Sanchez.
We weren't, like, the greatest, like, group of team. We weren't the best teammates in. Like, we were close, but we weren't there yet.
No, but I mean, yeah, you were there watching it firsthand.
But it's funny, when he first came up, the veteran guys who weren't really, like, engaged like they should have been, when Sanchez came in and he wasn't in a game, and we limited his innings, right? So he wasn't pitching in the eighth inning sometimes, and he was down on certain days. That pissed guys off. Guys that weren't engaged, like, they wanted to see him pitch. And that's what, just going back to that, yeah, the velocity was great. The sinker was great. He pitched a game in spring training at the beginning of 16. Last day of spring training in 16, he threw against the Rays down at Port Charlotte. And, like, it was electric. Like, he was out there pitching like he had something to prove. And pretty much the way he pitched all of 2016. But the majority of the veteran hitters are coming back saying, like, this guy's unbelievable.
How do you think this works out for Aaron Sanchez long-term? Because, as I just mentioned, you've seen him be incredible out of the bullpen. You've seen him be incredible as a starter. And I know it's obviously worth more than to any organization if the Blue Jays hold on to him, if he gets traded somewhere. He's obviously has more value as a starter. That's clear. Do you think the future is Aaron Sanchez as a reliever or as a starter?
I believe it's a starter. I think he's going to get it. I think there's a lot of blessings in this, learning how to pitch when you're not good. He's developed a much better feel for a changeup. He's developed different pitches, different weapons to help him get through the injuries. Mm-hmm. And I think that when it all comes together, those are the little things that are going to set him apart from everyone else. I truly believe in the guy. I truly believe his value as a starter. Now, it's nice to know that you have that bullpen thing sticking in your back pocket just in case it doesn't work out. But I truly believe his value is going to be as a starter, and he's going to be a successful starter again in this league.
That is Tim Leeper. My name is George Russick. This is Good Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Jays and Red Sox tonight, 7 o'clock right here, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and watch it on Sportsnet. Straight ahead is the president and CEO of Canada Basketball, former Raptors general manager Glenn Grunwald will join us. And then at the top of the clock, new Raptors guard Stanley Johnson joins us. Lots of hoops straight ahead, Leap. I'm jacked up. Are you jacked up?
I've been jacked up since.
All right. I like that. I like the cut of your jib. What's a jib? That's straight ahead on Good Show. Tim and George, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Now, prime time is anytime. Subscribe to the Primetime Sports Podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590, The Fan, on demand. This is Good Show with Ennison Bunkus on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
It's 1:32. Good Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. No Ben, no JD. They're back next week. George Russick, Tim Leeper here. Excited to talk to new Raptor Stanley Johnson straight ahead at 2 o'clock.
It's going to be great. We got British Open golf or
Open
Championship.
See, and that's something I'm a stickler for.
Yeah.
It's the Open Championship.
Championship.
Yeah, let's not.
I know. I messed that one up.
The Open Championship. And I think it's a little snooty the way they call it the Open Championship. But I'm drinking that Kool-Aid. I'm into the Open Championship.
Hey, my job's always to make the host look good, right?
You got a big task ahead of you to make me look good, my friend. We will talk the Open Championship with Jason Sobel, senior golf writer for the Action Network. He's going to join us at 2:30 as well. And we'll talk some hockey with Jeff Baker, NHL writer and columnist for the Seattle Times. The new expansion team has a general manager. And Jason Bay, former big leaguer buddy of yours, is going to join us at 3 o'clock. Looking forward to that as well.
I didn't derail his. I was his first manager, and I obviously didn't mess him up that bad.
Yeah, he had a pretty decent career. Joining us now on the line, he's the president and CEO of Canada Basketball, former Raptors general manager Glenn Grunwald. Glenn, how are you?
Very well, George. Yourself?
We are great. Glenn, how exciting a time is this for Canadian basketball? That we've never seen depth like this before. This is a big-time tournament. How excited are you to see this team in action in a couple months for real?
Well, it's going to be very interesting if you're a basketball fan. You know, we've got more NBA players from Canada in the NBA now than any other country, you know, it's exciting to see this talent. But I think what's also interesting is we have a lot of other players that don't play in the NBA that you know, given a break or a chance here, they would be NBA players. And you see some of those players on our roster as well. So we have a great depth of talent, and it's going to be up to Nick Nurse and Rowan to assemble a team that's not just the most talented team, but the best team that plays together and assigning roles and making sure that they're all tough competitors, because that's what's going to take in a FIBA competition.
You mentioned the name Nick Nurse, and he's obviously the head coach of Canada's team. When was the idea of potentially having him lead the Canada into this big tournament?
Well, we started discussions, I think, before the regular season ended. We came to a sort of a handshake deal before the playoffs began, and we agreed with everyone that we needed to keep this under wraps until the Raptors playoff run ended, because we didn't want to create any distractions for Nick or the team. So we sort of sat on it for a while, and And it went for a long time, which was great.
Yeah, definitely. Not bad, having a guy who just won an NBA championship as your head coach. How important is that for the program? Because we know in the past some players didn't want to play for Canada. And I don't want to say it was a disrespect factor, but I think there's a lot of legitimacy having a guy like Nick Nurse being the head coach of the national team, no?
Yeah, it's a great thing, but I think first thing I would like to say is that I don't think that's why some players didn't want to play was because of the coach. I think Jay and the other coaches that coached in the qualifying windows were all great and did a very good job. So I don't think that was a factor in some people not playing. But at the same time, to have Nick involved, first of all, he's such a great guy and such a good person and so wonderful to work with and has a great way about him, and he's been out recruiting like a college coach right now, trying to make sure that the players understand how much they're wanted and how respected they are and what Nick's vision is for the team and how he sees using them if they do make the team. So I think that's been a great addition, and the work he's done in that part has been awesome.
We obviously don't want to talk too much about the past because it's an exciting present and future for Canadian basketball, but what do you think were some of those factors why the big names didn't want to play for their country?
Well, it's not a question of not wanting to play. Like, each player is an individual. They have their own set of circumstances that they have to deal with. And we can't really know or even appreciate all of those issues that they go through. So they it's not that they don't want to play for the country. I think a lot of it is also, you know, what is going on in their lives, both professional and personal, and where they may be at in terms of contracts or injuries or things of that nature. So every one of those decisions is personal to the player. You know, as much as we'd want certain players to play, we just have to respect their decisions and move on. And fortunately, we've got some other, you know, really good players to fill in for those that are not playing.
How great is it to know that, I mean, in a situation like this, and you're qualifying for the Olympics, and I think the biggest thing is having players that want to be there. And sometimes it's nice to know that you can miss a player and not have your marquee guy show up, and still you still got a ton of players, a ton of inventory that you can use to go ahead and compete for this. Because tournament basketball is completely different than the regular season. And do you want to talk about some of the differences? Like, every game has the potential to be like game 7 of the NBA championship, and how important it is to have players that really want to play.
You're exactly. It's a passion play. If you're not out there to really give it your all and play with your heart, then you shouldn't be there, because these other players on these other countries are. And I don't think North Americans appreciate the importance of the World Cup or the World Championship in basketball. We always want to think about the Olympics, but in the world of basketball across the globe, the World Cup is bigger than the Olympic tournament. It's more difficult to win a medal in the World Cup than it is once you qualify for the Olympics, and that's because of the sheer numbers of competitions, and every point matters. So because it's a round robin tournament to begin the first two rounds, every point counts too. So as often you'll wind up with the same score. So the amount of points or point differentials what matters a lot in terms of where you wind up being seated or even advancing.
Glenn,
go ahead.
You talk about the importance of the tournament, and I kind of equated to the Olympics and the World Hockey Championships, because a lot of people in this country, we think of the Olympics first and foremost, but as the point you just made, in Europe, they take the World Hockey Championships really seriously, and this is a tournament potentially that the rest of the world takes a lot more seriously, and I hope this, with the exposure in this country and the United States, you just hope this tournament can reach that level of the Olympics.
Exactly. Yeah. And the rules are different, right? So you have your zone defenses. It's a more physical game in FIBA. The time is shorter. It's 10-minute quarters instead of 12-minute quarters like the NBA. There's often offensive goaltending and defensive goaltending is permitted. And like I said, the referees have a much slower whistle, let's say. So it's a physical game. It's an emotional game. That's why it was important for us to get a coach that had both experience dealing with NBA players, but also had success at the international level. And there's a few people around that had that. So fortunately, one was right here in Toronto.
He's the president and CEO of Canada Basketball, former Raptors general manager Glenn Grunwald, joining us here on Good Show. It's Tim, it's George. It's Sportsnet 590 The Fan. You talk about how difficult it is to win a medal at this tournament. What's the reasonable expectation for Canada?
Well, our goal is to win a medal and move on to the Olympics. And I think it's possible. Like, we have a very tough draw. We've got Australia first game, then Lithuania, two world basketball countries that have done very well. So that's the first round. And then Senegal is one of the better African countries. Our next round, we're probably playing France and Germany, two of the better European countries. So our work is going to be cut out for us. But if we have our players healthy and playing well together, we have as good a chance as anyone to get to the medal round. And then it's March Madness, right? It's a single elimination tournament, and fingers crossed that we play well in that game.
Can you talk about the importance of what it is to qualify for the Olympics? Obviously, you're in the Olympics, and that's the marquee venue, really, for sports in the world. But also what it means to you in terms of exposure, in terms of funding, as you guys continue to grow the game in Canada.
Well, like I said earlier, right, the Olympics are the most important things to North Americans, and to play in that tournament is great. When our women, I think, have played in the past three Olympics, and their ratings when they're on TV is as good as anything that's shown on the Olympics. So I know our men's team, if we were to qualify, would have similar exposure and benefit from that. And as you probably know, you know, the funding of the government is designed to reward programs or sports that have a potential Olympic medaling opportunities. So the fact that our men have not qualified for the Olympics recently has hurt our funding, while at the same time our women benefit in terms of additional funding because they are potential medal contenders.
Glenn, we see a lot of people on social media tweet that, "I haven't seen so many basketball hoops go up in my neighborhood since the Raptors won the NBA championship." What lasting effect of this Raptors run do you think it will have in Canada on basketball in the next 20, 30, 40 years?
Well, it was a powerful experience, a very memorable experience for a lot of people, and particularly young people. And I think, you know, I remember sporting events when I was a youngster and how they stick with me and how they may have influenced my choice in what I do and what I watch and what I follow. So I know it'll have a positive effect for basketball, whether it's kids playing basketball or following basketball or just people being more interested in the game and appreciating what a beautiful sport it is. So yeah, it's going to be a positive for a long time, and hopefully Canada basketball can continue to push that momentum forward.
Glenn, you knew this question was coming. We know that Andrew Wiggins is the biggest omission on the roster for Team Canada. What were the conversations like between his camp and yourself?
Well, I didn't have any direct conversations. Nick and Rowan talked to Rowan Barrett, our general manager of the program, talked to Nick and his people, and it became pretty apparent after some preliminary conversations that this was not the right summer for him to participate. So you know, you have to respect someone's decisions. I mean, our players are all volunteers. They don't get any money for participating. They're volunteering their time, and you know, literally millions of dollars of services are contributed to our program by our players. So we have to respect the value of what they're providing us and what it means to them. And so, like I said before, we're happy we have other alternatives, and wish Andrew the best.
Was the team disappointed?
I don't know if disappointed is the word, but, you know, we would have liked him to participate. But again, we respect his decision and, you know, again, wish him the best.
Would you guys welcome him with open arms if he decided, if everything goes according to plan, you guys win a medal and qualify for the Summer Olympics, which we're all rooting for? Would you welcome Andrew Wiggins with open arms to the Olympics?
Well, we have to see when that time rolls around, right? Right now, we're just focused on the World Cup. That's the challenge before us. And if we do well enough here, we'll then start worrying about the Olympics. Or if we don't do well enough here, we'll worry about qualifying for the Olympics in a qualifying tournament that'll take place next June.
How hard is it going to be to shape this roster? You got 29 guys coming in, probably 30 days together with I'm not sure how many exhibition games, but I know you have a general idea of who's going to be on your roster, but like how many spots are open? How are you guys going to go about forming this roster as you move ahead?
Well, it'll be, you know, I think the cuts are often made by the players themselves, and it'll become pretty apparent where things roll out. But like, you know, we do have some concern about the strength of our roster at the wing position. So that's one thing we'll have to worry about just in terms of depth. But I think we plan on taking 15 players with us to Australia for the exhibition tour there. We've got a 12-man roster for when the team actually starts competing in the World Cup, and we'll have to, you know, figure it out to make sure that we're not, you know, we're peaking our players at the right time and providing the right training program for them so that they're not overtaxed prior to the actual tournament beginning. So, yeah, we start on August 7th here in Toronto at a game against the Nigerian team for an exhibition game at Ryerson's Manami Center. And tickets are going fast, so if fans are interested in coming to see the national team play here in Toronto, they better get on the phone to the Manami right now.
Absolutely. Glenn, before I let you go, we saw how crazy NBA free agency is and these short-term deals and the amount of player movement in the league. Do you ultimately think it's good for the league, or do you like guys spending, you know, the majority of their career on the same team, building up those rivalries? Do you like the way free agency is shaped in the NBA?
I do. I think it's good. I think, you know, the NBA is 12 months a year now, and the soap opera that goes on around free agency and stuff like that is, I think, good for the sport, and it gives teams an opportunity to improve and jump to the top. You know, as disappointing as it was for Kawhi to leave in Toronto, I know that, you know, Masai is looking forward to the challenge of building another championship team. And notwithstanding his departure, we know that they're going to have a good team this year. The Raptors will be definitely in the playoff hunt, and we'll see where they wind up at the end of the season.
He is the president and CEO of Canada Basketball, former Raptors general manager Glenn Grunwald. Glenn, thanks for this. All the best of luck at the tournament.
Thanks, gentlemen.
There he goes. Glenn Grunwald. We're all rooting for Canada. I think this is truly the first time outside of Steve Nash playing in Sydney for Team Canada at the Olympics that we're really excited to watch a Canadian national basketball team compete. No, you got goosebumps.
I got goosebumps on it. It's tremendous.
We are really excited for this tournament. They play an exhibition game, as Glenn said, against Nigeria, a pair of exhibition games, and they'll also play the United States in an exhibition game right before the tournament, which clearly will be a great litmus test for where this team is at.
Okay, you know, going back, as you talk about Steve Nash, I remember him saying in 2012, thinking it's going to be 2020 before we have the players that are mature enough or in the game long enough to where we can compete at this level. And here we are. Now it's going to be interesting to hear how Glenn thinks after this tournament, because you go through these things and it's you're walking on eggshells. I mean, it's every game is important. Every game has a potential to be a game seven. There's some games you really need to win. There's other games that you try to get placement because you match up better. Mm-hmm. Tournament basketball, tournament sports in general, like it's a great thing.
I'm really looking forward to this tournament. And who knows, if Canada wins a medal, that would be a phenomenal accomplishment. And let's not forget, Ben Simmons, even though can't shoot a jump shot, he is not playing for Australia, and Australia is in Canada's group in the preliminary round, so that's already a plus for Canada because you want to see them get as deep as possible in this tournament, and it's just rich with NBA players. And the only thing it sucks is, it's in China. The time change is going to kind of hurt us for some of the watching of the games. I don't know what the actual games, when they'll be on, but I'm assuming it'll be either late or really, really
early.
They're
like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
But I'm going to wake up and watch those games because I'm really interested to see how Canada. And Glenn brought up the great point, and it is a great one. When you watch international basketball, sometimes it's frustrating. Some of the officiating's a little dodgy. Some of the calls you're not used to. The ball's weird. Like, there's just some things with international basketball that kind of gets getting used to. But I'm really excited.
You need to clear your head and like accept it for what it is, because it's kind of. And if you're a player and they can tell you can goaltend, how awesome is that?
Yeah,
that'd be the greatest thing in the world.
Now
I can barely touch the rim, but
now we had to broach the touchy subject of Andrew Wiggins with Glenn Grunwald. Well, we had to. It was our job. How much secretly are you hoping this team does really well and then they qualify for the Olympics? And then it's like, yeah, sorry, Andrew, we're good. You can continue to, you know, shoot 41% for the season and be a guy who's making way too much money for the Timberwolves and not really living up to your potential. Yeah, you can watch the Olympics from the sidelines. Yeah,
it's a touchy thing for sure. Like everyone wants to be a part of the big thing, right? But like, and having gone through this in baseball, like you want guys that are going to grind it out to get you there too. And like, there's got to there's got to be loyalty to the guys that get you there. And then the guys that are here, again, I think he hit on it perfectly. you got to want to play in these tournaments. You have to because you can't go in there. It is an emotion-based thing. It's not so much having the best players, but it's having the right players. And if you're not a guy who's into this 100%, there's no reason to have him on your squad.
How much do you think is the hockey factor in all of this? Because your relationship with the WBC, a lot of Canadian guys don't go for various reasons, right? Deal with injuries, but you don't feel the best team at every tournament. Canada, we haven't seen the best team in every tournament, but if it's a best on best, barring injuries, all the hockey guys want to go and play for Canada. Do we need to see success in these tournaments for guys to eventually say, I want to play for my country? Because outside of the World Championships, which Canada never really sends their A team, at the Olympics, they always send their A team. Do you think, and credit the United States basketball team. For every Olympics, they're sending their number one team. They're hammering teams. That's what they do. Do you think it's the hockey factor that we haven't seen enough success from these other teams for guys to say, yeah, I definitely got to play for my country?
I just think it's about where guys are in their career. And I don't think Canada has been in a spot where they've had guys who have been in the league 3, 4, 5 years. So if you're a guy who's a rookie and you're going through summer league and you're trying to make your squad the next year and your team's maybe giving you a little bit like, hey, we really don't want you to go. We don't want to... You know, they kind of stop you. You don't want to go over and get injured because your chance of making real money is here in the United States. I think that's where Canada has been. I think now that you have guys that are established in the league, again, that's where I think that's what Steve Nash was referring to. The depth you're creating with guys that have their money, care a little bit less. And I think deep down, everybody wants to play for their country in these things. There's no doubt about it. But there's so many other factors and life factors involved that make it so guys can't play.
Tim Leeper, George Russick, it is a good show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Straight ahead, Toronto Raptors guard Stanley Johnson. You're essentially his uncle because the amount of connection you have with Stanley. Okay, not really. No. But you do have a bit of a connection with Stanley Johnson. We'll talk to him.
So small.
And senior golf writer for the Action Network, Jason Sobel. We'll talk about the Open Championship as well. It is a good show. No JD, no Ben. George Russick, Tim Leeper, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Good show, good podcast. Subscribe to podcasts of Good Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan, on demand. More of Good Show with Ennis and Bunkus on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
O'clock. It's a good show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. No Ben, no JD. George Russick, Tim Leeper here till 4 o'clock. We hand things over to Primetime Sports with Jeff Blair. Straight ahead, Jason Sobel, senior golf writer for the Action Network. The Open Championship tees up early this morning coming up.
Can't wait.
In Royal Portrush in Northern Ireland. Looking forward to that and looking forward to getting some help filling up my golf pool. Are you a golf pool guy at your local bar? Or
you know what? I'm not at the local bar, but I'm just saying that just to make myself look good. But I've done well in the golf pools. We always had those floating around the clubhouse. I've always done pretty good. We may have to
talk. Do you have a formula? Do you have like a specific thing you like to do?
My formula changes from time to time. I'm a little bit all over the map, but I do a lot of reading, a lot of studying on it, and it's worked out for me. Maybe I have a magic touch, I didn't have in baseball.
You see, that's an interesting, I have to ask you a question now because of what you just said. Stanley Johnson, the Raptors, is going to join us. You just said you do well in the pool that floats around the clubhouse. Now, do players get involved in these pools?
They're involved.
Okay. So now this leads me to my next question. How lucrative are those pools to win if the players are involved and they want to make it interesting?
I will phrase it this way. It's not as lucrative as you would think, because if you're a coach and you're able to get in, then you realize I'm down with the rookies. I'm in the pool with the rookies and the clubhouse guys mostly.
How big is fantasy football, though, in
fantasy football is gigantic. And the one year we were rolling in 15... Chris Colabolo got Gronkowski to go to the fantasy football draft while he was in Boston. It was like one of the highlights of everybody's year. Yeah, it was unbelievable. It was like the best fantasy football draft ever. He brought him in the room. It stopped it.
Interesting. Chris Colabolo. That's an interesting name. We haven't really heard much of him since.
Yeah, that's for another time.
He's still looking for that guy who spiked his test.
I'll tell you what, though. He was a great guy.
I'm just saying.
He was a big part of what we
did. Oh, no question. He was a great player. Him and OJ are still looking. I'm just kidding. OJ's a murderer, and that's not even in the same stratosphere. Jason Bay, looking forward to talking to former Major Leaguer and Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame inductee, three-time All-Star Jason Bay. Again, we talk about how great Canada basketball is. Canada baseball always on the rise. We're seeing bigger and bigger stars coming up here. Canadians, one of the best players in all of Major League Baseball is Canadian and Joey Votto.
And how about the game the other day where Soroka was faced off against Quantrill, and they both pitched scoreless into the seventh. Like, it was, and Soroka's throwing bowling balls up there, and that's really neat to see. Canadian baseball, and again, it keeps getting better. And you touched on it with the basketball. You see more hoops going up all over town now everywhere. It's the same thing that happened to us in 15 and 16. The enrollment went up. Players are playing, and it keeps making us better and better.
Well, you're talking about Soroka. He's a kid from Calgary. Like, how tough is it when you're, I get all these American kids come from warm weather places, they can play the game all year, but you're from Calgary, weather isn't beautiful out there. How much pitching are you doing in a gym? Like, how, what
is this, great,
is it a disadvantage for us up here because of the weather?
I think it's a disadvantage because of the weather, but I think it's an advantage because if you play it, if you play the sport, you really want to play it. And, you know, Chris Rietzma also settled in Calgary, and that was a great tool for Soroka to have, and they were really close coming together coming up together in the junior program. And Rietzma had a great career with the Braves and a few other teams. And it's funny, you know, we're the country of outliers in baseball, right? And,
right.
You know, I think it was the perfect spot for Soroka at the perfect time. And Canada baseball continues to put out, like, not only, like, good players, like really great players. And, and they just kind of sneak up on you. And they develop later, so you don't have all the fanfare leading up to them becoming great. But all of a sudden, they become great. Hey, this city's got the greatest hitter, arguably, maybe in the game ever, and Joey Votto, and whoever heard of him before he made it to the big leagues.
Can we claim Freddie Freeman as our own? Because he played for you guys as the WBC.
Freddie.
Like, he's ours, right? Does he consider himself, what, half and half Canadian? What does Freddie Freeman consider himself?
It runs deep with him, with his mom. His family's really from here, and it's funny. We both grew up in the same area in California, so we're the Californianadians is what we call ourselves. But, yes, I mean, yeah, it runs deep with him, and it was actually a really, really big deal for him to play here. And I remember the first time he ever told me the story is when we were playing him in the Rogers Centre, and when he told me the story about his mother and what it meant for him to play for Canada, like, literally brought tears in my eyes, and I'm glad we have him, and, yes, Canadian.
All right, I like it. And he's a guy that potentially has had a phenomenal season with the Braves, and that's a team that could be doing a lot of damage come postseason. They got Dallas Keuchel on the mound today. That was a nice signing. And, of course, I think that's a team a lot of people in this city are rooting for secretly because the Blue Jays have no chance of making the playoffs. But I think we'd all like to see Alex Anthopoulos have a lot of success with the Atlanta Braves. Josh Donaldson's there. You got Freddie Freeman. There's a big connection here. I think a lot of Blue Jay fans will be rooting for Atlanta in the playoffs.
And they're really quiet right now. And Alex, obviously, he never stops, and he comes up with things that nobody ever even thinks possible, and he makes them happen. So it's going to be really interesting to watch him in the next 15 days to see what they do.
Yeah, it is interesting what the Atlanta Braves potentially could add to that roster, because the National League's tough. Like, there's a lot of good teams, and the Dodgers look out of this world. Who can dethrone the Dodgers in the National League? Can they get to another World Series? And you know they're going to beef up their roster as well at the deadline.
Half of the American League's punting, and the National League's getting
out. Yeah,
the National League Central is like
weird.
A great division.
As we wait for Stanley Johnson real quick, I just want to ask you, what's the over-under on the DH coming to the National League? Is that happening soon?
You know what? I truly believe it'll happen.
What's the time frame you think?
I hate it. Probably in the next CBA.
You hate it?
No, I don't hate it.
Well, you just said you hate. Do you hate it or no?
As a base, that's a good point. Hey, quit putting me on the spot.
Okay, sorry.
But as a traditionalist, I love the strategy involved with the with having the pitcher hit. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, and like, I think it's better when you have. I think it's a good thing when you have a bunch of hitters in the lineup. I think it's better for the game. People watch it. But nobody's hitting these days. Everybody's striking out.
Right. Is that old-school mentality?
Totally old-school mentality.
Like, if you're going to hit somebody, you got to go back up to the plate and answer the bell, too. I like that. The American League doesn't happen that way, right?
In the National League, when you manage, you got to put your thinking cap on. You really need to play the game way more ahead than you do in the American League. American League, it's easy. You got pitching matchups, righty-lefty. You can kind of play it out a lot more before the game. Lots of twists and turns in the National League game. And for me, it's a better strategy game. And it's a lot more fun to manage. But as the fans, I don't know if they see all that stuff.
We'll ask Jason Bay that question if he thinks they should have the DH in the National League, because he played in both. We'll talk to him at 3 o'clock. But joining us now on the line, the newest member of the Toronto Raptors, we say good afternoon to Stanley Johnson. Stanley, thanks for doing this.
Hey, thanks.
Stanley, is this...
Let me come on.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for jumping on. Is this Stanley Johnson or Patrick McCaw? Because we all saw the clip of you being mistaken for Patrick McCaw. Is that the first time somebody actually called you Patrick McCaw? And has been another instance where you've been mistaken for other players?
I mean, OG, I think you know it's tough a little bit, but Patrick, me and him, I don't think we look alike at all. But it's pretty funny.
You obviously, you signed here with Toronto, and we all know, we've all watched, when the Raptors play in Detroit, it always feels like a home game. When you were at the Pistons, how was it like when you're in your own arena and the cheers are louder for the visiting team? Did that factor into saying, you know what, maybe I should sign with the Raptors? That fan base is crazy.
No, man, it was really crazy. I remember my first year, I was talking to Brandon Jennings, and he was like, yeah, you know, this is going to be a home game for them. And I never could imagine, because I went to Arizona and I'm out of day and stuff like that. I never could imagine the more away fans coming to, you know, especially coming across the border and coming, you know, making it a home game. It was really crazy. And that really, honestly, I'm such a competitor, I really didn't even notice. But definitely when I was thinking about it in free agency, I was like, well, I know if I go here, the fans will be amazing. Obviously watching it through the playoffs and stuff like that, you see the support they had. And it wasn't even like they were like negative. Like some fan bases, it was negative. It was like a really like enjoying the game and stuff like that. And that I can really appreciate as a player and as a competitor. I know how much it helps having a fan base behind you.
When did the Raptors kind of get onto your radar? When did you start to talk to Masai and Bobby about potentially coming here? When did this kind of come to fruition?
I think, you know, between him and my agency, Bill and Nima, they have a good relationship with a lot of front offices and GMs. And for me, I always, you know, admired what was going on in Toronto before I was there, and especially seeing Masai in the draft process. They have a lot of coaches that I had seen in the draft process as well. But I couldn't really talk to them until I got in the free agency. And then, you know, really the first call, as soon as the time hit, was Masai. We talked for about 30 minutes, Bob as well. And after that, I was on my radar, and I, you know, went through the process with some teams. But I think at the very start, I felt like this is going to be the right spot for me, just what we were talking about and how I feel like I can, you know, come in and help right away, stuff like that. So
it has to feel great knowing that the defending NBA champions came after you early and came to you, and now you got a chance to be out there and are playing in Las Vegas. What are some of the things that you see out there in Vegas where do you realize, like, this is going to be a really good fit for me, and how is that going out there in Vegas for you?
I mean, from watching it from afar, I really didn't get a chance to watch a lot of games. I watched one game live, but I mean, I'm pretty familiar with Nick Nurse's system. It's very similar to Dwayne Casey's in Detroit, and you know, he lets players play. He lets versatile players play. You know, if you can defend and dribble and run, you look pretty good in offense. So, those are my skills. Those are some of my traits that I can bring to the table. For me, it's pretty simple. It's pretty easy for me to see, you know, how I would integrate myself into the offense and the defense and become a better player.
You talk about becoming a better player. What are some of the things you think you need to work on as a Raptor?
For me, I think it's just obviously staying locked in, more consistently, and just making the shots I'm supposed to make. I feel like if I can make the shots I'm supposed to make, I can bring some strength on the defensive end that's going to help, I think, any team. I can get to the rim and finish, and just making the jump shot I'm supposed to make. And that's what I've been working on all summer. I've had a long summer with us not making the playoffs with the Pelicans. So I've had a lot of time, and it's not just a one-year, one-summer thing. I've been working on it, you know, the majority of my whole career, going back through high school and stuff like that. So I think every year I've got a little better technique-wise and form-wise. And, you know, this year I'm looking for it to all come together at one time. And I think it will.
New Raptors guard Stanley Johnson joining us here on Good Show. It's Tim and George. It's Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Seeing Pascal Siakam, you know, be the sixth man of the year and how his career just exploded here as a Raptor. Every year he got better. Similar with DeMar DeRozan. He was a guy that worked on his game year in, year out. And it all happened here in Toronto. Are you expecting that with how the Raptors are great at developing guys, do you expect obviously the same thing? And was that one of the big factors why you ultimately decided to come here? Oh, is he gone? Stanley, you there? All right, we'll call him back. I don't know, like, his phone is a little wonky right there, but that's what happens when you deal with guests on the radio, Tim Leeper, and sometimes their phones. I want to know about the development because he's a guy, has a ton of talent. He talked about how he needs to work on his shot a little bit, and that was one of the knocks when the Raptors brought him in here that, yeah, he's a guy that needs to improve upon his shot. But if you look at an organization that's done a phenomenal job of developing players, Fred VanVleet, Pascal Siakam, OG Anunoby, the list goes on of guys who have improved their NBA career. DeMar DeRozan being in Toronto, and you think the same thing will happen to Stanley Johnson, and I think that's only a win-win for Toronto.
And there's obviously something they saw in him which made them believe that they could develop him into that
no
type
question.
Of player. And he's 23 years old, and he's still young. Yeah. He's got 4 years in the league, and he's still, you know, he's still young and got a long way to go. And it's going to, I mean, again, there's something they saw in him, and it's going to be great to see him come out here and compete. Again, yeah. There's a big ceiling for him.
And he's a guy that when the Raptors bring him in, and you know Masai Ujiri and Bobby Webster are at the helm of this organization, they have so much equity with the fan base. Why would you doubt Masai Ujiri and Bobby Webster potentially build another championship contender? They delivered an NBA championship. Yeah, it all sucks that Kawhi decided not to stay here, but when you hear some of the demands he was trying to make, I'm not saying I wouldn't have signed Kawhi Leonard, but some of those demands were outlandish, and Masai Ujiri's like, it'd be great to have you here, but we can't sacrifice the entire future of the organization for a guaranteed 2 years. You have to trust what the Raptors are doing, and if Stanley Johnson's a part of that future, he joins us again, new Raptors guard Stanley Johnson. Stanley, we're just kind of piggybacking on what I asked you. The Raptors have a great track record of developing guys, and guys just get better here being Toronto Raptors. Was that part of the factor of you signing here?
Yeah, me being 23, I know I want to get a lot better at basketball. And just seeing what they've done with Pascal and guys like DeMar DeRozan, you know, Fred VanVleet, Kyle Lowry, I definitely want to add my name to that list of players who got a lot better, and they've shown and proved it. So for me, that was really big. You just see guys around the league, and I think they've pretty much done the best job of getting, homegrown, getting players better year to year. And I've watched it with Pascal, being in LA, he's trained in LA all summer. So I've watched him get better. I've watched the work he's done, and I've seen that at work. So it's pretty easy to see and make the relationship between that.
Hey, Stanley, your mom was a Hall of Fame player at Jackson State. And how many games did she let you win growing up? Yeah, you know, 101 or horse games or anything that.
She didn't let me win any games. I ended up winning some games when I got older. I remember until I was about 12 years old, she used to beat me all the time. She had a really nice jab jumper, and she was 6'2". So until I got about 6'2 myself, I couldn't beat her. But she was a hell of a player, that's for sure.
Stanley, we hear a lot of negativity around here about, a lot of American players don't want to sign in Canada. What are some of the maybe misconceptions you have about Canada right now that maybe we can walk you through that aren't really true? Is there anything you're worried about moving to Canada here to play for the Raptors that you want to share with us?
No. I mean, I actually come to Canada a lot, Toronto a lot. He's like, let me come up for a week. So I'm very familiar with the city. I have no problem. I really didn't understand it, especially I heard some things this summer, obviously with Kawhi doing his thing, I don't know how hard it is this, and I didn't feel like it was that hard. I feel like Toronto is a great city. It reminds me of New York. Obviously, it gets cold. In Detroit, it got cold as well, and I thought it was good there as well. So I like it. It has great restaurants, a great basketball team. Great fans, and I'm really excited to play and move there.
Hey, Stanley, I'm from Brea, California, so I moved here. If you need any help when you get here, let me know. You guys wouldn't have won those four CIF championships at modern day, like maybe if we were close in age at all. I had the pleasure of playing for a really young Coach McKnight on some travel teams when I was in high school. Can you talk about what he meant to you? And you were with him 4 years. You're a 4-year starter in high school, and how he prepared you for life moving forward, and not only going to the University of Arizona, but for professional basketball?
He was great for me. I had a great time in high school. I think if I had one thing that I learned that was the most
influential on me, I guess, if that's the right word. It is. You just said that you're not gonna be able to basketball all your life, so take every day. Don't take any day for granted. And as a high school player, sometimes you get out there and you're more talented than the competition, so you start doing, you know, wild things, or you might not come in the gym every day extremely focused. And I think he told me that, and it took me a while, kind of hit me in the head later, but after I understood it, I definitely applied it now. And, you know, every time you go in the gym, whether it's a workout or just a game, you want to try to be your best and at your best, because, you know, I remember the day of basketball, you can only play for so long at a high level. So every day you have, go in there and give it your best and make it count.
Stanley Johnson, new Raptors guard. Stanley, we wish the best of luck. We'll all be watching. Thanks for doing this today.
Thank you, guys. Nice to meet you guys.
There he goes. Too. Stanley Johnson, new Raptors guard. He has no, you know, reservations about playing in Canada and for the Raptors.
The Raptors, to me, the very healthy organization. I mean, we're in a market where you have to nail your player development, and they have. Mm-hmm. And then again, once you start developing that reputation, it's going to be a lot easier to get guys in here. There's also like a little mojo factor. And like, we really, like for the Blue Jays, we had some mojo like in 2015, 16.
When guys came in
here to play, they're like, is it like this every night?
Right.
And anyone who came and played here the last two seasons, for sure, and definitely this year, probably feeling the same thing. Stanley said one thing on the interview I was watching online last night about the Raptors fans having a polite rowdiness. And I thought that was tremendous.
Totally. We are very polite, and they travel well. And you see Raptors fans all over the place, especially in Detroit, down that 401 West, to go yell and scream at Little Caesars Arena cheering for the Raptors. In your time with the Blue Jays, did a lot of American players have reservations playing in Canada? Was it the players from South America? Which players were like, I can't believe I'm playing in Canada? And do they ask you, you know, what are some of the things I need to know playing here?
The players from Latin America had absolutely zero problem. They're a little bit more adjusted. It was easy for them. The American players, the biggest, or the North American players.
See, that's weird to me, because so Latin players coming from a totally different, you know, culture, a way of life, and they come to Canada. Yeah, we're cool with it. And then American players, essentially American Canada are almost the same thing. It's essentially the same thing.
I don't know.
But American players can adapt. Are you serious?
Yeah.
There's English here. The Latin players do not speak English, and they come up here and they're like, yeah, I love it here.
Scotty told a story last week where he talked to Burley.
Come on.
Burley, the biggest thing was like the color of money was weird, and he was worried about
bringing it. But why is, like, how is that hard to figure out?
But
okay,
loved
anyway,
it.
Sorry,
he ended up loving it. And, you know, the biggest thing, the biggest fear the guys hear about, well, we have to go through customs at the airport. We have to do that. And once they're here, they realize, like, it's not that bad. And then actually the travel is relatively easy for us.
Leap, I don't understand why players are so worried about customs. Did drug mules play for the Blue Jays? Are they swallowing condoms full of blow to transport them into Canada? Like, what is happening? Why is customs? You show your passport and you walk through, you're on a charter. Customs isn't going to raid the Blue Jays playing game in, game out. What is going on?
Hey, there's nothing better than when you're in the airport and the dog's sniffing around and he starts sniffing at like somebody. You're like, oh, God, what's going to happen here? Hey, what am I messing? The dogs are always sniffing something, right? But sometimes they trail guys a little bit closer than others. It's always a little moment of
all right, maybe that's why. Yeah, maybe that's why they're worried about it. But it blows my mind that American guys are like, oh, Canada. Meanwhile, the Latin guys, no problem.
So we get spoiled like traveling. It's unbelievable. Like and someone takes our bags, they put it on the airplane, we get off the plane, we get on a bus, we go to the thing, we never see our luggage, and it's great. There's one extra step in Canada. Something you have to go through customs as you leave here. Mm-hmm. And again, they streamline us through. We're very lucky that way.
Right.
And again, people talk about it. You know, the bottom line is people didn't want to play in Boston at one point. People didn't want to play in Chicago at one point. You know, but you create a mojo. You create a healthy environment, much like the Raptors have right now, which mm-hmm. I think is tremendous. And all that stuff kind of seems to go away. And I think that's the important thing. That's the important thing. And I think when you have an organization from top to bottom, where you're all working together and you're on the same page, development matters and everybody feels a part of it, you got good things happening. And players want to play here.
Do guys really care about the turf at Rogers Center? Is that really a sticking point with some guys?
No, it wasn't.
Or that's overrated when we talk about free agency.
No one's talked about it at all, actually. On 5 years there, like I heard it at first, and then they changed the turf, and I've never heard another thing about it at all. And then players, we haven't had any problems because of the turf at all.
And having the dirt infield helped out as well, right?
Yeah, it helped out. But yeah, there was times like you realize what a home field advantage that created for us. And
how so?
How many balls? Like, because guys come in, outfielders immediately move back, and the turf. My first year used to be really bouncy, so guys would not attack balls. And I don't know how many. We won probably 4, 5, 6 games, whether a bunt that checked up on the turf in front of home plate, or balls that guys didn't come after in the outfield and end up taking weird bounces and going the other way. I mean, it did create a huge home field advantage for us.
That's Tim Leeper, former Blue Jays first base coach on Good Show. My name is George Russick. No Ben, no JD. Straight ahead, Jason Sobel's a senior golf writer for the Action Network. He's going to join us, and I'm going to share a story about how people really love their dogs. Are you a dog guy, Tim Leeper? Are you a big dog guy?
I'm a dog guy.
Like big dog guy?
I'm not a big dog guy, but I'm a bit of a dog guy. I'm much more a dog guy than a cat guy.
You're in the minority, because I'll tell you how some people are really big dog people.
You hooked me in right there.
Well, that's skull of tease, Tim. I'm not a mediocre broadcaster for nothing. It is Good Show. My name is George Russick.
I'm Tim Leeper. Around.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now, back to Good Show with Edison Bongus on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Good Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. My name is George Russick alongside Tim Leeper. Ben and JD are back next week, but straight ahead on our program, Jason Bay, former Major Leaguer, Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame inductee, three-time All-Star, will join us at the top of the clock. Looking forward to talking to Jason Bay. Buddy of yours.
Some questions I want to ask him that I didn't.
Are you going to Geraldo this interview? Are you going to really ask him some tough ones?
I'm going to have Roy Firestone. I'm going to try to make him cry.
Oh, really? You're not going to do it, Roy. Do you think we were a little hard on Glenn Grunwald there about the Wiggins thing? Do you think we got a little Geraldo-y there? Well, I think it was fair. Was it fair?
It was fair. It was okay, fair. But good. You know what? There's so many other great things. Yeah, it's nice to move on. But you know what's nice? Again, we just talked about it. Like when you lose a player like that, like,
yep.
Hey, next, right? And you got guys that want to play, and they're a super talented bunch. It's going to be great to watch.
No question. Jeff Baker, NHL writer and columnist for the Seattle Times, is going to join us as well. The new expansion team has a general manager in Ron Francis. And what's up with the name? When are we going to hear the name? And how much pressure is on the Seattle franchise and Ron Francis now to hit a home run like George McPhee and the Vegas Golden Knights did?
It's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out. There's a lot of lessons to be learned from Vegas, but also like that also set the other teams into like defense mode. So it's going to be that's the chess game that I'm going to love watching this thing play out.
Yeah, we'll talk to Jeff Baker about that as well. But first, he's a senior golf writer for the Action Network. We say good afternoon to Jason Sobel. Jason, thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me, guys. I love the Open Championship. One of my favorite weeks. Also, there and talk hockey with you the whole time too.
Oh, really? Like, what do you think the Seattle team should be called? What if you're going to put some money down on their name? Do you like the Totems? Is that your favorite?
Oh no, I hadn't heard that one. I'd seen something where there was a vote and there had like 4 or 5 names, and I remember really liking one of them and thinking that's got to be the name, and now I can't remember what it was. This is a nod to the old baseball team. They had the old baseball team, the Seattle Pilots. What if they went back to Pilots?
That'd be all right. I wouldn't mind that. Were you like me? Were you disappointed that it was the Golden Knights, that they could have had such cooler names in Vegas than that team?
Yes. Yeah, I thought it was terrible. Still, for as good as that team has been, for as impressive as they've been over the first 2 years, it should have been a better name. I don't love the colors. The jerseys aren't great. They could have done so much better. I feel like if you're starting from scratch with a franchise, you have a chance to, like, do something really special.
Yeah, it should have been the Aces, right? Like, the Aces, something with gambling. Like, the Gamblers, it would have been something cool like that. Have, like, a cards as your jersey. It would have been awesome.
So.
For sure.
Yeah, hopefully Seattle Seattle has like the old Sonic, like they take the colors from the old Sonics uniforms and sort of take that, like the green and yellow, I think would be pretty cool.
That would be definitely really cool. Sticking to the gambling theme, a lot of us are filling out open championship pools, and clearly Brooks Koepka has been the guy who has been absolutely killing it at majors lately. And then all of a sudden his caddy, Ricky Elliott's a guy who was a member at Royal Portrush for years. He's played over 1500 rounds of golf and has that thing, knows that course backwards and forwards. Is Brooks Koepka your favorite this weekend?
Yeah, it's funny. I spoke with Ricky about 2 weeks ago when I was in Minnesota for the 3M Open. It was only 1,000 rounds then, so he's got an extra 500 in the last couple of weeks.
Well, no, I don't know what it is. I heard it on the Golf Channel last night, Jason. They said 1,500 rounds. I will take your word for it if you spoke to him. Yeah.
I'm sure they spoke with him. I'm sure he said it. So I'm totally throwing Ricky under the bus here. Koepka's among the two favorites. I have no problem with the books listing Rory McIlroy as a favorite. He's played so well at the Open Championship ever since winning in 2014. Hasn't been outside of his top 10. So last I've seen, he's 7-8-1. Brooks about 10-1. Has played so well, of course, at the major championships. And yeah, has that weapon of Ricky Elliott on the bag. I'm not sure how much that's going to help him other than maybe it deflects some attention. He's going to have the whole home crowd rooting for Ricky instead of rooting for him. And I don't think he seems impervious to everything, but maybe that helps him just a little bit.
Jason, when it comes to Ricky Fowler and Brooks Koepka, Koepka said this, and we had the clip yesterday of talking about how he doesn't really practice. He only practices ahead of majors. And if you see him playing golf, that's the only time he plays on television. Do you believe him that he doesn't practice that much outside of the majors?
He's told me the exact same thing. He said, look, you guys all think that I go home and I say I don't practice, but secretly I'm out there practicing. And he said, no, that's why I like playing the week before a major, because I don't even take clubs out when I'm at home. I go the week before a major. Like, for instance, he played AT&T Byron Nelson a few months ago, and that was his warm-up for the PGA Championship, finished in 50th place there, and then won the PGA. It's just like, hey, I want to get some practice. I'm playing this tournament to get some practice in. He goes to the majors, so it's working really well for him. I do believe him. I don't think there's a whole lot of developing bones in Brooks Koepka's body. I think he pretty much shoots from the hip, and what he says is pretty much truth.
So Brooks Koepka is essentially the greatest trunk slammer of all time. Is that what you're trying to tell me, Jason Sobel?
He's a wizard. I mean, he's figured out something that no one in the history of the game has figured out, in that he all has to show up to the majors and doesn't really care. And he sort of said as much that he doesn't care that much about the non-majors and just goes out and wins majors, wins a couple of majors every year. No big deal.
And speaking of guy who hasn't won a major in a long time, Rory McIlroy, it's kind of weird that 2014 is the last time he's actually won the major. And we know all the pressure's on Rory every year at the Masters to complete the career Grand Slam, but how much pressure is on him this week to get it done at home?
Well, you hit the nail on the head there. I think that no player has had more pressure on him at a single event than Rory at the Masters over the last couple of years, trying to claim the career Grand Slam. And yet this week, being back in Northern Ireland, grew up an hour away, I think the pressure is tenfold, a hundredfold. I mean, there's going to be the hosts of an entire nation resting on Rory's shoulders this week. And we've seen how he plays under pressure. He plays good, but not good enough at Augusta National so far. And I don't know that that's going to translate to what everyone at the home crowd wants to see this week, which is a victory and him raising Clara Jug on the home front. So I don't know that Rory's going to play his best golf, but certainly he's capable of going out there and playing great golf. He's played the best of anybody over the last half decade at the Open, and sure wouldn't surprise anybody if he's able to do it.
Hey, what's it mean to the guys from Ireland to play in this course? Like, it has to be obviously special. They haven't hosted the Open Championships in 68 years, since 1951. And even like Graham McDowell, his younger brother, he's part of the greenskeeping staff there too. So, but what does it mean, like, politically, like socially? What does it mean for these guys?
They have called it the biggest sporting event in Northern Ireland's history, and it really is. This is a big-time major event for them, having it there. Graham McDowell, we all know what he went through trying to qualify, finally got through the RBC Canadian Open a month ago, and really cool to see him going back to not just his home country, that's his home course. He grew up with Ricky Elliott, playing there every single day when he was a kid, so the fact that he's back there is really neat. Darren Clark, is a member of the club. He's going to be hitting the first tee shot in about 11 hours from now. And it's really neat for these guys to be able to play in their home country, which they didn't think would ever happen.
Jason Sobel, senior golf writer for the Action Network, joining us here on Good Show. It is George, Tim Leeper, Sportsnet, 590 The Fan. The defending champion, Francesco Molinari, has a good record in majors this year, was right there with Tiger Woods in the final at the Masters on Sunday. What are his chances to potentially defending his title at the Open Championship?
You know, ever since losing the Masters, Francesco's been a different player. Has not played his best golf. You remember last year, he was red hot. He was the best player in the world, according to the results, going into the Open Championship. And he's a guy that tends to get into form and ride that wave of momentum. Right now, he doesn't have that momentum. And I'm a little leery of whether Francesco can turn it on this week and play his best golf. We haven't seen a defending champion since, I believe, Patrick Harrington about 11 years ago. So I think it's going to be a little tough for Francesco to sort of get it back to where he was last year and play his best golf this week.
What kind of golfer does the course favor? I mean, it seems to be a little bit of a mix of everything.
Yeah, it does, which is the sign of a good golf course. I always say that the best courses, the best championships are the ones where if you're a long driver, you got a chance. If you're a great ball striker, you have a chance. If you're a really good putter, you have a chance. I tend to think this one will suit the ball strikers more than anyone else. I think this is going to be the one where you see guys who hit their irons really, really well, hit them close to the pin. Guys like Adam Scott, guys like Patrick Cantlay, guys like Hideki Matsuyama. I think those guys are going to have a really good chance here because putting should be neutralized a little bit, unlike a place like Augusta National. You won't see guys holding a whole lot of 20- and 30-foot putts, but you won't see them three-putting either. No one's going to be missing three- and four-footers. So you would think that the players who struggle a little bit with their putting but strike it really well should have a good chance this week.
That kind of leads me to Dustin Johnson. He's a guy, one of the best players in the world, one of the most longest hitters on the planet. Jason, why does he continue to kind of fly under the radar here, and is he one of your favorites?
Yeah, it's weird. He's ranked third in the world. He has a major championship. He's obviously one of the best players, and yet we don't talk about Dustin as much as we probably should. His Open Championship record leaves a little bit to be desired. It's good. It's not great. Again, like I said about Rory and Brooks, has the talent to go out and win on any given week. It's just a matter of whether he can get the ball into the hole. So we'll see. I'm not positive. I'm not convinced that he's figured out links golf yet. I think he still needs a little work to figure out links golf and figure out how to play these golf courses. But again, he can figure that out this week and certainly be a contender on Sunday.
Jason, we've talked for over 5 minutes and the word Tiger Woods, the name Tiger Woods hasn't come up.
Yeah.
Clearly, do you like his chances, or do you think taking way too much time off after his win at Augusta National, which is understandable, wants to rest his body as well, but is that just too much time off from tournament golf to be a real threat this weekend?
Look, Tiger said at the beginning of the year that he was going to play a lot less, and he has. He's played three fewer events than anybody else in the top five right now, and he's only played 10 rounds since winning the Masters. So it's not much competitive golf. He took 2 weeks off, went with the family to Thailand, and didn't pick up a club during that time. And if you read between the lines during his press conference yesterday, it just sounds like he's a little pessimistic. Sounds like he's not quite on top of his game and where he needs to be this week. So, no, I don't love Tiger's chances, but long-term, looking ahead to the next 5-10 years, if Tiger's going to win a 16th major championship, it might come at an Open. We've seen older players win Opens. It's a tournament where guile and experience can help you a lot more than power and speed. And I think Tiger can work his way and strategize his way around an Open championship course, but I don't think that's going to be this week.
You've already mentioned guys who don't have a major in Hideki Matsuyama and Patrick Cantlay. Are they the two guys without the major you think are the favorites to win this, or a guy like Ricky Fowler can finally get things done in a major championship?
I really do like Ricky. I've always liked Ricky at the Open Championship. More creatively than most other elite players, and likes being creative out on the golf course. I think that helps him at these courses where you can't just see things on one line. You have to see things from a different perspective, and he does that. And if you've been backing Ricky Fowler for the last 5 years at major championships and you're 0 for the last 5 years, at some point you feel like you want to jump off, but there's a little Fowler FOMO out there. You just feel like, hey, at some point, he's going to win one of these, and I just don't know that this is the time that I'd jump off Ricky Fowler right now.
Jason Sobel, senior golf writer for the Action Network. Jason, thanks for this. Enjoy the Open Championship.
Thanks, guys. Set the alarm. Let's go 11 hours.
Yeah, we will. We'll do it. There he is, Jason Sobel. And Tiger Woods is a guy that is Kenny. I don't know why you would doubt Tiger Woods now. I didn't think, you know, he could win at a Masters. This is the tournament I thought he could potentially win another major at, because as what Jason said, you have to be creative and you have to be crafty to win an Open Championship. But Tiger really doesn't like his, well, not that he doesn't like his chances, but do you expect Tiger to be right there on Sunday?
I'm right with you, Jason. I saw the same thing Jason said, and like, usually, you know, he doesn't give too much about his game. It's always very positive. The takeaway I got from watching him speak about it in his game, he said his game's not up to par or not sharp enough for this thing, and now I'm wondering if he's slow playing us that he believes
right.
he can win, and obviously he believes he can win every tournament, but the fact, my concern is the same thing. The fact that he hasn't played, the fact that it's such a challenging course, and it's going to take a lot of shot making. I don't think we're going to see him there at the end.
I love the fact that this is the final major of this season. I think the PGA Tour did a fantastic job of rejigging the schedule a little bit, moving the PGA Championship as the second major. And we have a golf major every month. Starts with Augusta in April. Then we have the PGA in May, the U.S. Open in June, and then all of a sudden, bam, we have the Open Championship, and it's done. And then the FedEx playoffs, which is fine because a lot of diehard golf fans love the FedEx playoffs. But these are the four tournaments that really define careers. Everything he just said about Brooks Koepka and not practicing blows my mind. Like, how does a guy who has won four of the last eight majors essentially use a tournament as a tune-up to play in the majors, and he doesn't pick up a golf club? That is insane to me, because golf is insanely difficult.
It has to be the best feeling in the world. But there's guys like that. There's guys that go out there, the more they care, the worse they are. And, you know, you can't argue with the success he's having.
That's incredible to me that a guy.
It is.
I guess you have to believe him, because we played the clip and we were skeptical. Justin Bourne was co-hosting me yesterday. He didn't believe it. Well, according to Jason Sobel, yeah, that's.
We've had three or four people verify this, so yeah. It must be true.
And obviously, we talked about it. I don't know how many rounds now. Jason Sobel said he talked to Ricky Elliott. He's played over 1,000 rounds at Royal Portrush. And then I heard on Golf Channel last night that it's been 1,500 yards. Let's just cut it in the middle. He's played over 1,250 rounds at Royal Portrush, but that's definitely some course knowledge. And Tiger Woods had something funny to say yesterday during his availability that he wanted to play with Brooks and his caddy a practice round to get kind of the course knowledge. And Brooks ghosted him. Didn't return a text message because he didn't want to give Tiger the advantage of getting Ricky Elliott and some of his course knowledge.
And Ricky was out there with Adam Scott quite a bit and said he probably gave him a little bit too much information, especially with the greens.
Adam Scott's a guy who always blows my mind. He's a guy that incredible ball striker. But his putting, it's so in his kitchen. He's a guy that needs two putters too. He has his long distance putts and his short distance putts. Where have you ever heard of a guy you went golfing with who brings two putters? You know that's in his head. And that's what punting is all about. And Jason just brought up a great point. This could be a weekend of ball striking. So if you're skewing towards guys who are phenomenal putters, maybe you don't need those guys who roll it exceptionally well. And to me, Adam Scott's near the top of that list, a guy who doesn't putt exceptionally well, but is a tremendous striker of the golf ball.
For me, I take two putters in my bag just because I know one's going into a lake somewhere.
Have you ever thrown a club in the water?
Oh, yeah.
You've done that?
It's great. Corey Hart, I was playing with Corey Hart, the AAA hitting coach in Buffalo one time.
I was going to say, like the singer, the Canadian singer, never surrender Corey Hart, sunglasses at night, but no, a AAA hitter?
I had this great persimmon hook face three wood, which I loved, but I finally hit a bad shot and I just lost it. Yeah, I have thrown clubs
in
the water.
And you just, like, you helicoptered, boomeranged that thing into the lake.
Yeah, it was one of my better tosses.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting. It's 247 in his good show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. That's Tim Leeper, who clearly needs some anger management. My name is George Russick. Straight ahead, former big leaguer Jason Bay,
he'll
Canadian Baseball Hall of Famer.
He'll be able to testify to
this, too. Yeah, we will. A three-time All-Star. But first, are you a dog owner?
I am a dog owner.
Yeah, are you hardcore dog owner?
I'm not hardcore.
You're not super hardcore?
No, I'm not super hardcore. So, I'm not buying the outfits, anything like that.
Okay, your wife, is it your wife's dog or is it your dog?
The dog, hers.
Okay, so now there's a study that came out by Riley's that a large number of dog owners, they prefer their dogs to their partners. Now, you can attest to this. 52% of people admitted in this survey, they kiss their dog more than their partner on a daily basis.
Ooh.
Does your dog get more sugar from your wife on a daily basis than Tim Leeper does?
That would absolutely.
Yeah. So you're right. So your wife is one of these people in this survey. She's getting, you know, she's kissing the dog more than you on a daily basis. So 52% of dog owners say they kiss a dog, their dog, more than their partner. Now, this is the one that really got me. 52% as well said they prefer to share their bed with their dog more than their partner. Have you been ever kicked out of the bed for the dog?
Never. No. The dog's.
Okay, so that, no dogs, that doesn't apply to you.
No.
Does the dog sleep in bed with you?
No.
Okay. Down on the floor?
Door shut. Yes.
They're okay, out. So the dog is not in the room.
Dogs are out.
Okay. So you're in the minority of people. 52% of dog owners say they sleep on the bed.
So I've learned I'm not in the minority. I'm not also learned this week I'm not a millennial.
Yeah, you are definitely not a millennial. Neither am I. I don't know what generation. I think Generation X or something weird like that. I don't even know what it is. And then lastly, 94% of dog owners admit their pet was one of their best friends.
Yeah, that's not me.
Not you, but your wife?
No, there's a balance there.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so.
What kind of dog is it?
Collie and a mutt. So, yeah, and the mutt, she hit with her car and decided that she needed to take it in
That's really nice of her.
Very nice.
But we know that at the Leeper household, the dog gets more sugar on a daily basis than Tim Leeper. Straight ahead on the program, we'll talk to Jason Bay, former major leaguer, Canadian Baseball Hall of Famer, and three-time All-Star. He was a guy who was a big-time signing by the Boston Red Sox. And we got to ask him, too, what was the pressure like? Because we touched on this about contracts and when you sign a big contract, how much pressure is on you. How much pressure did he feel when he signed that big deal with the Boston Red Sox, playing for one of the marquee franchises in all of baseball?
It'll be interesting to hear what he has to say. But he went from the Pittsburgh Pirates, who were never involved in any big games, to going right into the heat of the battle in Fenway Park and then a year when they were really good. So that'll be interesting to hear.
And how did he play the outfield in Fenway? That's clearly the quirkiest park in baseball,
it's
right?
It's quirky, and it's funny, like you think it always favors a hitter because it's so close, but like how many balls that are smoked that don't go out and end
especially
up
especially in center field,
as
right?
Singles, center field, yeah, goes, but like left field, there's the amount of singles that or balls that would go out that don't even come close to, you know, going over the wall, and again, it's a single, not a double.
Before we get to Jason Bay, how tough was it for you to tell a guy at first base at Fenway Park? Was that the toughest place to read a ball, where it's going to go and how's it going to
There's
react?
There's very few places where, like, you matter as a first base coach, and that's one of the places because, yeah, runners got their head down, they're running around, and guys are messing balls off the wall all the time. How they play the ball off the wall is important. Plus, the field kind of crests in a way where sometimes you don't even see the ball. So you have to be vocal.
Really?
You have to be on top of things, and it's the one place it can mess you up a little bit. I mean, having done it for 5 years, you know, it becomes a little bit easier. But again, if a player hasn't played there, he has to put a lot of trust in you as a coach to listen to what you have to say.
I have to ask you, because we've all watched a bajillion baseball games, and we always see when a guy gets a single and the first base coach is there and he comes over and says something to his player. What are you saying in that moment? What give me some of the things you've said.
Usually if you have a base running team, it's like before the game, you tell them, hey, what you're looking for, what the situation might be. Here's what you're looking for if you're going to steal. So the biggest thing is kind of, as a first base coach, you're very proactive in trying to play the play out before it happens.
Yeah.
So you're trying to tell them what could happen in those situations. We were such a slow team the last couple of years.
Right.
I really didn't have a lot of those conversations.
So when Kendrys Morales was at first, you didn't have the, you're going to steal a base to talk with him.
It's very basic. It's very basic. Hey, man, if he gets a single or if he hits a double, just try to make sure he gets to the next base.
Okay, so that's basically what it is. And you tell him the situation.
Yeah.
But is there anything with the timing about the pitches?
There is with some guys. Absolutely, there is. And, you know, there's little keys that you look for in their delivery that you're trying to get out of the gates quick and things that you're looking for. And there's certain guys in certain situations, yeah, where it's important that for me to know the time and for the base runner to know the time.
I'm glad you told me that, because I always wondered, you know, what are they talking about there from first base?
I got a great Morales story, but I'll tell it later. It's
okay,
too long.
Well,
right now.
No, now we got to do it in the 3 o'clock hour. We have one more hour to go. Jason Bay, former major leaguer and Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame inductee, three-time All-Star, is going to join us. And Jeff Baker, NHL writer and columnist for the Seattle Times. They got a general manager, but they don't have a name yet for the team. We'll do that. One more hour to go. Good show. Tim Leeper, George Russick, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Yeah, it's a podcast, but we're still not going to let him swear. Subscribe to Tim and Sid at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. More of Good Show with Ennis and Bunkus on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
3 o'clock. It's a good show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. No Ben, no JD. They're back next week. My name is George Russick alongside Tim Leeper. Straight ahead, we love talking about hockey in the middle of July, and we'll do that with Jeff Baker, NHL writer and columnist for the Seattle Times. They have a general manager for the expansion team. We don't have a name yet. So we are looking forward to that.
It's big news. Hockey offseason is a little slow right now. I've noticed that in the past few weeks.
Yeah, it gets slow after July 2nd because everybody just goes up to their cottages and don't care. But meanwhile, there's way too many balls in the air right now when it comes to the NHL and restricted free agency. But joining us now on the line, former big leaguer, Canadian Baseball Hall of Famer, three-time All-Star, we say good afternoon to Jason Bay. Jason, thanks for doing this.
No problem, guys. How you doing?
Good. You're from Trail, BC. Are you going to be a fan of the new Seattle hockey team? What are you a Canucks fan? What's your favorite team?
Leap knows this, but I live in Seattle. So, I'm already looking forward to it. I tried to get season tickets, but my wife said with the three kids that the chance of us going to 40 games are probably not great. So I'll get a 10-game pack or something. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
What name do you prefer out of the ones that have been thrown out there?
I honestly don't even know which ones have been out there. I know everyone's trying to get trying to do a mixture of the Sounders, Sonics, and Seahawks, trying to build off of that, but I don't know what the finalists are.
Interesting. Totems is one that a lot of people throwing around. Do you like that?
Yeah, it's okay. It's a little WHL-ish, but...
Yeah, it feels like it's WHL. Like, do a lot of people, they don't realize what a good hockey market Seattle potentially will be? Obviously, the NHL does because they're having an expansion team there, but living there, are people really excited about the NHL coming?
Oh, God, yeah. When they did the first drive of the season tickets, the push, I mean, it sold out in a couple hours, and I think that, you know, it's a great sports town. It's just getting bigger and bigger, too, and, you know, with the success that the Seahawks have had lately, the Sounders, you know, they were expansion team soccer. They won it their first year, and boom, they're 30,000 people a night for soccer. So they're just looking for things to get behind, and, you know, I think hockey would be perfect.
We're going to switch over to baseball here for a little bit. We got a guy here in Toronto, a guy named Billy McKinney, who I'm a big fan of. He's a guy following kind of a similar career path to you. He was a first-round pick of the A's in 2003. He got traded to the Cubs. Then he got traded to the Yankees. And then he got traded to us here with the Blue Jays. And he's kind of like, you know, struggling to make his mark. And it's kind of like fitting in between things. The one thing going through the minor leagues and getting traded so much, and you have been through that. I mean, you started with the Expos. You went to the Mets. You went to the Padres. And then you went to the Pirates. Like, what are some of the things that were difficult adjustments for you? And when you change teams so much, like, what's the psychology about that? Like, what do you feel when you go through all that stuff?
Good question. I mean, I think that, you know, his case is probably a little bit different than mine being a first rounder. I was not. I was a 22nd
well established rounder.
And, you know, you could look at it one of two ways, I guess, is, you know, it's kind of someone doesn't want me or someone does. And I think it's a lot easier to look at the latter because, you know, you're getting opportunities. I mean, for me, I was kind of moving along, and I was getting a chance to play. And that's all I was asking for. And, you know, and so it just kind of boiled down to getting the right situation. I mean, I played with a lot of guys that probably had way more talent than a lot of guys I ever played with, but never got in the right situation, never kind of got a good break and took it. And me getting to Pittsburgh, you know, and they just said, hey, look, we don't have anybody else. It's your job. You go with it, you know, and I would say that, you know, he's in the big leagues right now, and now's a chance to make that mark. I mean, it's, you know, it's just about getting the right opportunity, and some people just don't get it.
Jason, you talk about starting off in Pittsburgh, and then you signed a big free agent deal to go play for the Boston Red Sox. What was your wow moment when you started playing for the Red Sox?
I was just getting there. I mean, I'd been in Pittsburgh essentially. I played a few games in San Diego, but most of my career was in Pittsburgh. It's kind of all I knew. And, you know, I had some great personal success, but as a team, you know, we really struggled. And so all of a sudden I get the phone call and overnight you're there. And all of a sudden it's like, wow, it's the atmosphere was different. I mean, it was completely different. It was like, you know, this is, you don't do it for the accolades. And, you know, you get there and you're like, this is why we play baseball. This atmosphere, I mean, this electricity, like this is fun. This is every day. You know, you're not chugging a pot of coffee to get that, you know, that energy. It's like you walk out there and it's an instant pot of coffee. And that was just the difference overnight for me. It was palpable. You could totally tell.
What are obviously here in Toronto, there's going to be some players traded at the deadline. Like, what are the thoughts as a player leading up to the trade deadline. And you went through it once. It's easy to sit here and say to the pad lines, well, I just got to go out and take care of what I'm going to do. I just got to go out there and play. But you got friends calling you, wondering where you're going to go. You got your family who's probably on edge wanting to move. Tell us what the emotion of the trade deadline in the next 20 days is like for you.
It's stressful. I mean, I was on the block there. Pittsburgh was kind of rebuilding, and I was one of the guys that had name was bantered around. So I kind of knew it was out there. I didn't actually think it would happen. And I'll say this, that as a guy who has been traded, 90% of the things that you see or hear out there are completely made up or like news to me. You know, my buddy will call, hey, I heard you're like news to me. I have no idea. You know, like these are all coming from random places. But it's different. I mean, especially for someone that had never really been traded in the major leagues, it's kind of all I knew was Pittsburgh. And, you know, I think on some level, most of those guys, when you're comfortable, no matter what your situation, you don't really want to go because it's what you know. But once you kind of get through it, once you get the phone call and you get into a different situation, like, okay, and then the logistics are the hard part, you know, the family, moving the family, what do I do with my car, you know, like all these things. And I told a story, you know, when we were in St. Mary's last week or a couple weeks ago, it was just, you know, when I got traded in Boston to Boston, I got called at 4:00, went home, packed my bag up, went home, told my wife I got traded to Boston, and then I was on a flight the next morning at 10:00 in the lineup that night in Boston. But we owned a house in Pittsburgh, which we knew could possibly happen one day. We had a, you know, 1.5-year-old. My wife was 8 months pregnant, and it was like, sorry, hon, figure it out. And she did. You know, having a huge support staff really helps.
Jason, when you get traded, do you pay attention to what you're traded for? Are you like, oh, that's a pretty good haul they just traded for me? Do you pay as a player? Do you look at what you're like, man, they only gave up that for me? Like, is that something you looked at when you were a player?
It did in the minor leagues, for sure. I mean, it was kind of, like I said, I was every situation I had, you know, I was kind of like, oh, wow. You know, and somebody, you know, the first time was like, you know, kind of fringe guy. Oh, then someone I've actually heard of. And then like, oh, an all-star. And it was like, okay, I'm feeling pretty good about that. But when I got traded in the major leagues, it was more about not who for, but where am I going to? That was the bigger question. So, yeah, I think on one level you definitely kind of evaluate your worth a little bit. But if you're comfortable with where you're at, it's a non-issue.
Hey, we're heading down to Lima here next week to compete in the Pan Am Games, going for our third straight championships. You got a nice career in baseball Canada. I'm not going to talk about 2001 in Taiwan, where you and Morneau actually probably got to watch the tournament more than you played in it. But can you tell us a little bit?
You did talk about it, though.
Yeah, I did. I just wanted to throw that in there. But can you talk a little bit about your WBC experiences? One of the best memories for me was coming off the field when we played in your first game, and it was our first game when we played South Africa. And what do you remember about that? And talk about your time here, and we played the game in Toronto as well.
WBC was awesome. You know, it's just, you know, it's like any time you kind of get everybody together for, I guess, a country, you know, it's different. And not, that had been done, you know, some junior teams, and I never got to play on the Olympic teams or any of that stuff. And so for me, it was, and for a lot of those guys, it was kind of the first time we got to do that. And, you know, I'll say it was just, you know, because it was the first time we did it and it was new, it was way too early in the season to be feeling that intense. It was just, you know, some guys got like 8 spring training at-bats under your belt, and all of a sudden it's just this, you know, this huge wave of motion, and it was really cool. It was just definitely different. And you know, I remember when we beat the U.S. in that one game there, and, gosh, that was – I mean, I'd been in Pittsburgh my whole career. That was kind of that playoff feeling, you know, that win right there. That was really cool. And, you know, I always loved going to Toronto, you know, having a little maple leaf up by my name, you know, that it was always kind of different. That being said, the Toronto fans didn't really care if I was Canadian. They still let me hear it every day in the outfield. I don't care if you're Canadian, and that made it even more fun.
Former Major Leaguer and Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame inductee, 3-time All-Star Jason Bay joining us here on Good Show. It's George Tim, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
You got to experience like the Rogers Centre in like full playoff glory. You know, the one thing I remember about that game, you had the great at-bat at the end of the game. It was probably like a 10 or 11 pitch at-bat. I think we were down by a run. I don't know. You remember that? I remember being the third base coach, and I think Lowry was on second base and getting absolutely horrible secondary leads. And the whole time I'm sitting there, man, Jason, please don't hit a single. Please don't hit a single, because if I get Lowry thrown at a home plate on a Saturday in Canada, like, I'm not going to hear the end of this. But what did it feel like to be in Rogers Center, like in a playoff-type atmosphere? And then how was that game? What are your memories of that game?
I remember everything you just mentioned. I mean, getting that at bat in the ninth inning. I remember looking around and seeing the place. I mean, it wasn't an empty seat there. It was full top to bottom. I remember, you know, looking over in the U.S. dugout and Adam Dunn was checking his pulse. I mean, it was just like everybody was like, what's happening right now? It was so electric, you know, for February/March baseball that it was just it was almost surreal. It was kind of this. You know, and it was Canada, U.S. too, so there was this whole other feel to it. But I mean, you know, that place, you know, you felt it in the playoffs. But I mean, you know, especially with the dome and stuff like that. But you get that many people, and in a venue like that, it's literally, you know, you can't hear anything. It was electric.
Jason, you obviously won the Rookie of the Year in 2004. You're the only Canadian to win the Rookie of the Year. We know Mike Soroka is having a great season with the Braves. Are you secretly rooting against you to keep that title?
Oh, absolutely not.
All right, you want him to share it with you. Okay. I like the fact that you're the only Canadian guy. You want to share it. Okay.
What kind of guy would I be if I said I was rooting against him? But no, definitely not. I mean, you know, I think it's been really cool that, you know, when I was kind of growing up and the guys that came up when I did, you know, Canadian baseball was Jason Dixon, Matt Stairs, Larry Walker, and there wasn't, you know, a whole lot else at the time. And then since then, and Larry would be so pissed if I said because of him, but you know, since then there's been this huge wave of guys, you know, Rookie of the Years, MVPs, Cy Youngs, you know, you name it, and I'm really hoping that continues. You know, you kind of get more of those guys involved, and you know, it's like I said, it's not because of those guys, but I mean, we got a lot more Canadians doing a lot better things in the big leagues now. It's pretty cool.
Touch on the Hall of Fame experience. I mean, I'm sure in your life you didn't set out to, like, be in the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. What was it like when you got the call? I want to tell you, great job. The one piece of advice I gave him before he had his induction is make sure that you give your speech before Dempster. And from what I understand, I think you schooled him. I think you schooled Dempster. Is that true?
I don't know if I schooled him, but everybody seemed to take a lot more time. I had wrote my speech on the back of the directions on how to get there the night before, so it was definitely winging it from the heart. But you know, the whole thing was really cool. You know, I didn't really know what to expect. I kind of got a phone call from Scott out of the blue, and it was just like, wow. I hadn't been playing for 5-6 years. It was kind of the last thing on my mind, and it was like, oh wow, that's really cool. Thank you. You know, and I didn't really know how to quantify it until we kind of got there. And then all the guys that were around, you know, a lot of the, you know, past inductees and just a lot of the, you know, the other guys I play with, the Canadian guys, the ex Blue Jay guys coming up, you know, it was just, it was really fun. It was just kind of like a really low key kind of party. And to kind of see all these guys and be part of that, it was a blast.
Jason, before I let you go, we let things off with the Seattle name, and we dug up some of the potential names. So I'm going to give you the names for the Seattle NHL team and what you like. Okay, so we already said Totems. They're the favorite right now, according to Vegas, to be the name of the team. Here are the other ones. Emeralds, Rainiers, Sockeyes, Kraken.
Krakalakken.
What was the last one?
Kraken.
Seattle
Kraken? Yeah, it's like a Bigfoot kind of like creature. Yeah.
I can see why Totems is in the lead then.
You don't like any of those? Evergreens?
Yeah, the problem is that when you're around, like, you know, when you're around here, you know, the Rainiers is the AAA baseball team. You know, the Emeralds, it's okay. I don't know. I guess I do like Totems.
All right, so there you go. You're on board with Totems. Yeah. Former major leaguer, 3-time All-Star Canadian baseball inductee, Jason Bay. Jason, thanks for this today.
No problem, guys. Thank you.
Appreciate it, man. Thanks.
Yeah, I guess Totems is in the league. Kraken's a sea creature. Sorry, it's like an octopus kind of thing.
Jason Bay said Totems are the favorite. I'm in.
Yeah, like Emeralds, too. Do you like Emeralds?
Not really, but it's also the same thing. There's covering on a bunch of baseball names. There's Eugene, Oregon has a team called the Emeralds, so I don't know if they have to.
The Whales? That's too close to the Whalers. You can't do Whales. Cougars? That would be an interesting
insert joke here.
Yeah, there's teased hair, tight jeans. You can have their logo. The Eagles.
That's high schoolish.
No, you can't do the Eagle. Firebirds. You can't do Firebirds. Sea Lions.
No.
Like, is a sea lion really? Ooh, we're playing the Sea Lions. And the Renegades.
Like, I kind of like the playing off the old the basketball, don't the
ever,
Sonics.
Don't ever name a team after my favorite defunct CFL franchise, the Ottawa Renegades, because ooh, I'll always be a diehard Ottawa Renegade fan.
I lived in the city during those dark moments.
It was definitely dark. We're going to get to Jeff Baker, NHL writer and columnist for the Seattle Times. He's going to join us. We'll ask him about some of the potential names. They're naming Ron Francis as their next general manager. How much pressure is going to be on him to kind of hit a home run like we saw George McPhee do with the Vegas Golden Knights, and who's potentially on the radar for the expansion draft. But before the break, you said, we mentioned the name Kendrys Morales, and you said you wanted to share a Kendrys Morales story with everybody, and now we have to share it.
A situation last year, bases loaded. I think we're in a position to win the game. It's the ninth inning, and we have the bases loaded. And then the first pitch, he took a secondary lead. So I'm obviously speak English. He speaks predominantly Spanish. So in my very, very best Spanish, cuidado línea. Cuidado línea, no secundario.
Okay.
Which is watch the line drive, don't take a secondary lead.
Right.
And he goes, okay, next pitch, he takes a secondary lead, line drive to second base, and he gets doubled off. So we went from, like, I think they even had a five-man infield on us. So we went from winning the game to, like, getting doubled off, and he looked at me and just goes, lo siento. which is better than the time we had one player get picked off second base, and I come to the dugout, I'm kind of mad, and he looks at me and goes, yeah, I just got you fired.
Really? But how tough is that language? Like, how good is your Spanish? How tough is the language barrier with some of these
There's
guys?
There's baseball Spanish. It's actually not that hard when you, like, go to baseball. Like, the biggest thing is to, like, make sure you stay with conversations. Like, even like Lourdes Gurriel, like, I wish I spoke more Spanish because he's such a great human being. His family's great, and I've been around them, you know, with my Baseball Canada stuff, I've been around his family for, like, mm-hmm. for over a decade, and they're really neat people. In terms of baseball stuff, it's good. You just got to remember to stay with the conversations. A lot of times I say yes because I think he understands what he says, and they say the same thing. They say yes. And when you find out, when you get past that and you stay with conversations and you make sure you follow them through, like, it's not bad. I've coached teams in the Dominican Republic through Dominican season and Caribbean World Series and stuff, so it's never really been an issue.
When John Gibbons was let go as the manager of the Blue Jays, that was one thing that was talked about, that it's important to have a Spanish-speaking manager, especially with the young Spanish players coming up in the Toronto Blue Jays. Did you think that was important? Do you think it's a necessity now in today's game?
It's helpful. I think it's helpful. I like the fact that teams are going, like the Miami Marlins are teaching giving Spanish classes to all their English-speaking coaches, which I think is an absolutely smart and wonderful thing to do, and I think other teams will do it. By the time players get to the big leagues, most Latin American players do speak English, and there's really not any problems. I think it's very helpful. My response to that was the Dominican Republic team didn't care when I was coaching them in the Caribbean World Series, so I think it helps. Every little bit helps. I think it's great to know languages. I think it's great to be able to communicate more with players. And do I think it's absolutely necessary? No, because I think there's ways around it. And you tend to feed off your personality more than sometimes in just the language.
How concerned are some of the Latin players when they have to do interviews in English? We know Edwin Encarnacion, when he was here, he used an interpreter. But a lot of people around the team said, no, Edwin's English is pretty good. Is it a comfort factor? They don't want to be misunderstood. Is that why they kind of like to use an interpreter?
I think that plays a part of it. And listen, you get a break at the end of the day. And sometimes when it's not your first language, you really have to grind and to get those sentences out. And then sometimes, even if it just takes one, there's no mulligans, right? So if someone misconstrues something they say and they write something, you know, there becomes a little bit of level of distrust. And it's probably a little bit easier sometimes just to go through the interpreter, make sure the message gets out there the right way. And, you know, I think as guys go on and they become more comfortable with it, it's not as much of an issue. But I can liken myself going to Dominican or going to Mexico when I played. And sometimes it was just a break not to have to, at the end of a game, not to have to grind through, like, trying to speak my second language and try to get my point across. So I found it easier always to use an interpreter.
We know one of the reasons was potentially to get a Spanish-speaking manager was Vladdy Jr. And you said your time in the Dominican Republic. He's been called, and I heard this, and I thought this was really interesting, the son of the Dominican, that people have known about Vladdy Jr. there way before any of us heard of a Vlad Jr., and they knew eventually because of who his dad was and because of just his raw talent as a child, they knew eventually this kid was going to be a superstar baseball player. How is he viewed in the Dominican, and is he the kind of the son of that entire island?
It's different. Like, yeah, all that's true. But, like, one thing about Vlade, like, how much did that translate to North America, too? Like, he's 19 years old, and, like, people from coast to coast knew about him
right
before he even got here, just because of the way the game is and social media and the access to information, the minor leagues, which didn't used to be there. I think Buck Martinez said it best. Like, nobody's ever come to the big leagues with such fanfare. And
right.
You know, That's true. Baseball's a way of life there, and if you're in a family or you're a big time baseball player there, like, people know who you are. So I think he's kind of accustomed to it. It's kind of just a way of life that he grew up with in Dominican Republic. I think it was harder, like, probably being the center of attention here as much as he was.
Do you think he's pressing too much at the plate?
It's hard to be it's hard. The big leagues is difficult.
Like, oh yeah, like the hard pitch. Yeah, of course. But do you think he's pressing?
The thing you need to look for when a guy's pressing, are they starting to swing at pitches out of the strike zone? His strength is like knowing his strike zone and getting after it. So when guys start chasing hits, that's when he's got to worry. Like, so like you get in a hitter's count and you're looking for that fastball, and the fastball comes and they're swinging at it, even if it's out of the zone, that's when you know they're pressing. This is probably the first time he's had this kind of challenge in his life. And, you know, when you look at him and people say he's struggling, he's still a rookie. He's hitting .255 and his on-base percentage is right there. It's going to click for him. For me, it's going to click for him this year, and it's going to happen quick. I mean, I think someone said you wouldn't be surprised to see him knock 10, 15 home runs out in a month. And I could definitely see that happening for him. And it's just a matter of, like, he gets everybody's A pitch every at bat, because it's a team that doesn't strike fear into a lot of teams, right or wrong. And everyone knows that this is a guy that can beat you with one swing of the bat. So mm-hmm. Nobody's taking it easy. No one's laying a 3-0 cookie or 3-1 cookie in there so he can just wail on it and hit a home run. He's getting good pitches every single pitch that he gets. And they're not afraid to walk him to get to the next guy. And once he shrinks his strike zone, starts offering the pitches that he can handle, which is a lot, that's when you know he's good. But it's Major League Baseball is – it's everything, right? It's defense, offense. In the minor leagues, you can get by being an okay defensive, just a so-so defensive player, because there's not like a tangible, there's not a tangible, like, if you make an error, like, it's not the end of the world in the minor leagues. You make one in the big leagues, like you realize the importance of it. And that carries over in your at-bat. And I think he's just figuring out the balance between all those things.
I asked Keegan Mathison the question, because I heard Kevin Barker say it on Baseball Central today that the third baseman of the Blue Jays in 2020 isn't on this team yet. Do you think Vladdy's the third baseman of this team heading into next season?
Should he be? Yes. And again, the greatest thing about the offseason is you take a step back and look, he's gone through a lot. Like, there's people with him every single bit of the day. Like, whether it's infield practice, whether it's hitting practice, whether it's media requests and all these things. But you have the offseason, you get to go home, you get to regroup, and you get to assess your season and the areas you want to get better on. If it means a lot to him to become a better third baseman, the offseason's where you make your bulk of improvements. And for me, yes, he comes in next year as a third baseman. And I'd be willing to bet, just because of the kind of baseball player he is and how he wants to succeed, he realizes how important all aspects of his game are. And also, you get to go home and do it kind of on your own without people, like, constantly on you. And I think that's when you see your greatest areas of growth, or your greatest growth. So I think it'll be interesting to see how he comes in next spring training. If I had to bet on him, I think he's going to be better at all things next year.
When we talk about Vladdy Jr., it's hard not to talk about his weight and his body type. He's already a big kid to begin with. You've seen him, you know, up close and personal. Is that something that is a concern for Blue Jays fans moving forward? Or do you think that's going to be something that, you know, will be handled correctly? Or is that going to be something he's going to have to deal with the majority of his major league career?
That's an easy story. And you can say, okay, he's big and he, whatever. But, like, he's also, like, he's also an outlier, right? Like he also does things that nobody else can do. Like, if you look at his minor league numbers, there's nobody that even compares to them. So, like, he's been able to achieve unbelievable amounts of success being the way he is. And there's nothing for me that tells me that this weight is going to, like, hinder him becoming, like, a really good defensive player or a really good player. And, you know, it all lies with him, right? Like, it's just a matter of what's important to him, how he comes back in the offseason, and what he learns from this year and how he uses it going forward.
We all saw how he dazzled us all at the home run contest. It was incredible that a 20-year-old hits that many lasers out to the outfield, and something came up, the word man strength. Wait till he gets his man strength. How scary is Vlad Jr. going to be where he hits his mid-20s and he's at his peak physically?
I can't imagine him being any stronger than right. he is right now.
But
right?
he is going to be, right? It's just human nature. He hasn't hit his physical peak yet, and he's about to in a few years. How scary is that going to be for pitchers in the major leagues?
It's going to be scary because, like, he's a really, really smart kid, and he's a really advanced hitter. And, like, he's going to shrink the strike zone, and he's going to start, like, just offering at the pitches. And also there's going to be a better team around him, which is he's going to get more to hit. And that, based on the fact he's going to have experience under his belt, like, it's scary to know, to think how good this guy's going to be. I know it's not the start everybody projected coming in, but for me, it's like following exactly the path that it should. There's no telling how good this guy's going to be, and it's going to be great because the players around him are, and it was that way through the minor leagues. Those guys helped make him better. He helped make them better, and I think that's kind of where they're trending.
Assuming that Vlad Jr. is that guy who's going to be that superstar we all think he is, who's the guy out of that group of players who's going to be right there with Vladdy? If you could put money on who's the guy who's going to have the second best career behind Vladdy, who's that guy on the team right now?
That's a great question. But the beauty of the group that's coming up is they're all a little bit different, and they're like, it's like a jigsaw puzzle, and they all kind of fit together because they each bring a little bit of different things. Kevin, to me, and again, this is on my limited experience, like, he's really professional. He's kind of the leader. He knows when to like say that. He said he's baseball all the time, right? And he knows when to say the right thing, not only to players but to coaches. He's the kind of guy that makes everybody better. Where Bo is a guy that plays really like he loves the game. Like, when you watch this guy go, I can't wait to see him come up because he loves the game. And you watch him play, there's an energy factor there. And again, all these guys together in their own different, because they all have different personalities and they all hold each other accountable. I think, I don't know who's going to have the best career.
All right, here's a question. Who do you think's the second most talented out of those guys?
They're talented in all different ways. You talk about raw ability. You're going to say Bo Bichette.
Okay.
But like, there's so much more to it than that. Because, like, of course, I said, Kevin's a lot more cerebral, and like his plate discipline for a young hitter, like, is off the charts. Like, there's no telling how good that's going to be. But if you just looked at it from, like, if you were just a guy who never watched a baseball game and you watched it, you'd probably say Bo Bichette.
That is former Blue Jays first base coach Tim Leeper. My name is George Rosick. This is Good Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. One more segment to go. NHL writer and columnist for the Seattle Times, Jeff Baker, is going to join us. They have a new general manager. They don't have a name for a team. And how much pressure is on this team to be competitive right out of the gate? We'll talk to Jeff Baker straight ahead. One more segment to go. A Good Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Send us all your money. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher, and we'll send you a free subscription for Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Absolutely free. Now, back to Good Show with Ennis and Bonkus on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
It's a Good Show on Sportsnet, 590 The Fan. No Ben, no JD, George Rosick, Tim Leeper here for another 15 minutes or so before we hand things over to Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch for Primetime Sports. We've had fun today. I've enjoyed my time with you.
I've enjoyed it as well.
I think you're lying.
Thank you for carrying me.
But I am telling the truth right now that I've enjoyed our 2.5 hours together. And we're not done because we get to talk to Jeff Baker, NHL writer and columnist for the Seattle Times. Jeff, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks, guys. Good to be on.
You're a familiar name to the people in the city of Toronto. You used to cover the Blue Jays. Do you still have a soft spot for them? Do you still keep an eye on what's going on here with our Blue Jays?
Oh, yeah. I always keep an eye on them. And my old colleague, Richard Griffin, is now running their PR staff again. So it's nice to see things come full circle for him. And, I wish them well. I know they've had some rough times this year, and unfortunately, I was there for so many years, and I didn't get to cover them in the playoffs, and so it was nice to see them in the postseason a couple of years ago. But, I've moved on and living here now, and I do kind of keep track of things going on close to home, was happy to see the Raptors win the title as well. So I've got to spend a couple of days in Toronto, actually, in between the Toronto part of that series and the Oakland part, the early part of that series. Oh, and nice. So got to see the impact it had on the city. That was nice.
How electric are those Blue Jays Mariners game in Seattle? And do the people of Seattle and the fan base kind of resent the fact that all these Blue Jays fans get to Safeco?
Yeah, you know, they laugh. I tell them all the time that when I covered the Blue Jays, the fans there were some of the quietest fans in all of baseball. I never saw those kinds of crowds following them around when they played in Toronto. It was only when they came here and all the British Columbia fans came down that they really turned crazy. I know they went a little nuts during the playoffs a couple years ago, but when I was there, the Rogers Center was one of the quieter places in the game, and now it's hard to explain what goes on. They really do resent it. They feel like they're being invaded by by a foreign nation of fans, and I guess they are in a lot of ways. But that's the law of the marketplace. You know, if your team's good enough, you're going to buy up all the tickets, and the visiting fans won't have any. So you have to get your home team better, and then you don't have that problem.
Jeff, we do have a winning streak in wars with the United States, the 18-12. Canada won that war, so we're up 1-0 on the United States. Seattle has an expansion NHL team. They hired a general manager, Ron Francis. How much, and he was part of this building process of the Hurricanes getting all the way to the Eastern Conference Final here as their general manager before he was replaced in Carolina. How much is the success of the Hurricanes and what they've done was the decision-making for hiring him as the new general manager of the Seattle franchise?
Well, I think you have to give them some credit for that. I mean, you see this in all walks of in all lines of sport. I mean, you can't just credit the current general manager for what's going on. Obviously, he laid the groundwork. The top two scorers on that team between Aho and Teräväinen were both brought there by Ron Francis. You know, he had some missteps as well. And I think part of the issue now, I mean, the game's changed. The game of hockey is changing tremendously, as are other sports, baseball as well. I mean, you just don't see the patience out there anymore for these five-year rebuilding plans. And, you know, in the case of some cities, we won't mention them right now, they go on for 10 years and 15 years, and that's too long in my book. But I don't know that Francis had enough time to put together what he was trying to do in Carolina, given the payroll that they had at the time. They were among the worst payroll teams in hockey. You know, despite the salary cap, they still didn't have the budget to get a lot of things done. It's going to, from what I'm told, it's going to be a little different here in Seattle. They're going to be willing to spend a little more money, and we should get a more accurate representation of what Francis is capable of doing. And I'm interested to see as well. I mean, he started to do some work with analytics down in Carolina and was putting together a nice team to do some work down there. They're already building that team up here, and they're going to have it running full throttle, they hope, within 2 years by the time they hit the ice. So that should be interesting to see as well what he can do when he has that up and running on the fly and he has a team ready to go and a little better support, I would say, from ownership.
I think a lot of fans were maybe surprised that Ron Francis was named a GM. How long has he been on the radar in Seattle?
He's been on there for quite a while, actually. And you know, from everything I heard, they were interested in him going back a year ago. Especially because Dave Tippett, who played with him in Hartford, of course, but for some of those interesting Whalers teams, Dave Tippett was a senior advisor here for NHL Seattle, was hired almost a year ago to the week, or it might have been last June, a year ago last June. And so clearly, when they're looking for a GM, Francis's name is going to be one of the first that pops to mind. But, you know, he had just, you know, removed himself, he had just been removed from the equation in Hartford. A lot of guys at that time, especially when they're still being paid, he was still under contract by Carolina. He's still being paid by the Hurricanes. And so, a lot of guys in that situation tip it as well. It will take a year off and get paid by somebody else to sit there and play golf. And, from all accounts, he did some of that. Ron Francis, he also worked for Team Canada at the Spengler Cup and, started working a real estate company. So he wasn't exactly sitting around his house, but, yeah, you know, it's good to get away from the game sometimes, see the broader picture. And they knew that. They knew that, it wasn't going to be worthwhile to pursue him right away. And also, they had to get permission from their own ownership to hire somebody a year early because, you know, normally you'll hire them a year from now, your GM, and then give them about a year and a half or just over a year to prepare, let's say, for the expansion draft. Now he's going to have two full years to do it.
Hey, there's a lot of lessons to be learned. Obviously, Vegas just went through this a few years ago, and it seems like George McPhee, he benefited from making deals, which he promised not to take certain players and It's one of the reasons they got Alex Tuch from Minnesota. Is it safe to say that he has some different challenges that they had in Vegas, knowing that the other GMs have gone through this just a few years back?
Oh, certainly. I don't think you're going to be able to count on all those preemptive deals that Vegas saw made prior to the draft. I think there's going to be a few, but I think teams are going to go into them with eyes wide open and be looking not to be made fools out of. Some GMs, unfortunately, were by the Vegas Knights. I think they're going to be looking out for those kinds of things and realizing, hey, at worst, you're going to lose one player who's good in these things. What you don't want to do is lose two or three of them who are good and also lose two or three of them and make a direct rival better, as happened in some cases with the Knights. So they're going to be really cautious about that. And I think the entire organization here has done a pretty good job of trying to lower expectations and not have those direct comparisons to the Knights. I mean, I've heard CEO Todd Leitwicke go out and speak in public, and one of the first things he always says is, we're not going to the Stanley Cup final in our first year. You got to get that out of your minds, and everybody laughs at the time, but that's part of the problem. Everybody thinks they're going to win a Stanley Cup in the first year or get to the final. And you know, there was just such a confluence of events that did that for the Knights. And it required participation by the other, 30 teams at the time. And you're just not going to see that this time. So yeah, he does have to do some work. And I think the analytics are going to play a huge part in that. They're going to have to find some under the radar guys that aren't there and try to target those and hope that, if they do entice teams to make deals preemptively, that they can go out and get those guys.
He's an NHL writer and columnist for the Seattle Times. Jeff Baker joining us here on Good Show. It's Tim George, Sportsnet, 590 The Fan. Jeff, where are we at with the naming of the franchise? Do you expect that to come sooner than later? And what's kind of the favorite in your mind?
Well, it's not going to be the Kraken, I can tell you that. And that's a huge favorite for some fans here of gimmick names and cartoonish names. But I think the serious people who realize that sports is a business and a multi-billion-dollar business, they know that they're not going to name them after a fictitious character in one of Jerry Bruckheimer's movies, despite what the logo would look like. So it's not going to be Kraken. I wouldn't be surprised if they used Kraken in one of their farm teams, maybe, but it's not going to happen here at this level. I really don't think it's going to be the Seattle Totems, which is another sentimental favorite. There's just too many interesting connotations with Native American communities that they want to avoid. And also the fact that totems aren't really indigenous to this part of the world, to the Pacific Northwest. They were brought here from elsewhere, and that's always been a bone of contention around these parts as well. Even though Totems was the name of the AHL team, makes a little sense. I don't think they're going to go in that direction. Metropolitans, they're not going to go in that direction, I can tell you. So, I mean, my pick would be something to do with fish. I like the name Sockeyes. I've heard them mention that quite a bit. I think they could go that route. I've heard Sasquatch as well, but that goes the cartoonish route again. I'm not sure they want to go that way. So I can definitely rule out names. I don't think it's going to be Kraken, and I really don't think it's going to – I'm pretty sure it's not – I know it's not going to be Metropolitans, and it's not going to be the Totem.
Does it have to be a team nickname ending in starting with S, like the other teams in Seattle, or are people really adamant about that?
No, I haven't heard that. Some people like the name Sockeye, singular with no S. But in today's NHL, you don't know if they're going to go for that either because of the connotation with, getting punched in the eye and Sockeyes. They're trying to get away from violence in the NHL. So you never know. I mean, they're pretty serious about that. I don't know. Everything they're doing has to obviously be approved at the league level in advance. I've heard they're down to about four names right now, and that they're going to actually allow Ron Francis to have some big input in the name. They're going to allow him to have a big input in a lot of things, but the name's going to be one of them.
Jeff, before I let you go, obviously everyone's excited for NHL hockey to come. Is there NBA basketball back on the horizon in Seattle? What's the sense of getting a team back there? Clearly, Key Arena's being renovated for the NHL team. How far away is the NBA to returning to Seattle?
Well, Key Arena is also being renovated for the basketball team. They've spent a lot of money trying to get it up to standard, not only standard but above standard for both things. And I've heard people say that there's no intention to get basketball here. I think that's ridiculous. I think it's foolish to say that when you have a guy like Tim Leitwicke who's building Key Arena, and Tim Leitwicke's been connected to so many NBA franchises, including the Toronto Raptors recently, and helped set the groundwork for what happened there. And then you've you've got a majority owner in David Bonderman, who's already a minority owner of the Boston Celtics. I mean, it would be foolish and frankly absurd for anybody to bet against it coming back there. And given the connections between the Lywicki brothers and Adam Silver, I think, you know, chances are a good 90-95% we're going to see team here sometime in the next 5 years. You know, that said, it's not going to happen overnight. I mean, look at the Montreal Expos, my hometown team. I mean, they've been gone now from Major League Baseball going on 15 years, and probably going to be a good 5 years before they come back, you know, no matter what Rob Manfred says right now. And so, you know, that's a good 20-year wait. And, you know, the folks here in Seattle have to learn to be patient. It hasn't been that long in relative terms compared to other franchises in other cities. They've only been waiting. It's only been waiting for 11 years, but that's and it's a long time. I agree, but it's not long relative to the rest of the teams in sports that have had to relocate. And so, I think they will get a team back here. It's just when the NBA is ready to have another franchise, they'll put one in Seattle. But right now, they're not ready to welcome another franchise. So until they are, we're just sitting and waiting.
He's an NHL writer and columnist for the Seattle Times, Jeff Baker. Jeff, thanks for this today.
No problem, guys. Anytime.
There he goes, Jeff Baker. He thinks they'll be called the Sockeyes, or singular, Sockeye.
Do you like that? I actually like that one.
Do you know that the sockeye is the third most common Pacific salmon species after pink and chum salmon? Did you know that?
That I did not know.
And would their jerseys be pink? Salmon pink? Because salmon is a tough fish. Swims upstream, right? It's a tough fish. Pink jerseys? Do you like that?
I don't like that.
There's no pink jerseys in the NHL. Maybe the Seattle team can be pink.
You got to be a real man to pull off pink.
Well, I'm wearing a sort of pinkish shirt, a salmonish shirt. This isn't really salmon.
I would go with magenta.
Yeah, I'm not really good with colors. It's kind of reddish, pinkish in the middle. Magenta is a good thing. So Jeff talked about how there needs to be a serious name. Sockeye is a serious name. We're playing the Sockeyes. They're a fish. That's serious enough for you?
Like I said earlier, I think names, and it takes a little while to kick in. There's no name that ever came out that you're like, that's a slam dunk. That's a great name. Not that I can think of.
That's interesting because the Blue Jackets came out. You were like, ugh.
Yeah.
Not really. The Wild is still a terrible name, and their terrible logo. The Minnesota Wild, it sucks. They could have done a lot better. Minnesota, Colt, I don't know. I just think Grizzlies. I think of Minnesota. I think of Bears. That's still a terrible name, but it's taken. But something to do with, you know, Wild. Really?
Yeah.
That one sucked. Which is your baseball? Is there any names that you're not a big fan of? Did you like Marlins?
It fits, but it's a bad market, right? Like, yeah. There's not a lot of fans, but it does fit. And I worked there, and it became kind of a household name for me. So,
did you hate the fact that Tampa dropped the Devil Rays and Rays?
No, I think that was one of the best things they ever did. And I think
really?
Their uniform
there was a was curse?
Good. But it's also like, it's Tampa. And again, we talked about the stadium last week, and where Josh Johnson called it the Walmart of Major League Baseball. I don't think you can't have a good name there, right?
It is really the Walmart. Do you think they moved to Montreal?
No.
You don't think so?
No.
Can baseball ever work there except for spring training baseball?
In Tampa, in Montreal, I think, yeah. Tampa, no, not in Tampa, not where the location of the stadium is. There's absolutely no way. And Florida, and as a rule, like, I don't think baseball works there. It's great for spring training, and that's it.
It's a heartless state for sports, isn't it?
NFL.
Outside of college sports, right?
Yeah, in college sports and NFL, yes.
Yeah, because they don't really. Well, the Dolphins have a big following there, but the Jags, meh.
Yeah.
The Buccaneers, meh.
Yeah. It's the same. And Jacksonville, that's so far north there. It's different. Right. But they have a nice little niche there for sure.
That's Tim Leeper. I've had a lot of fun today. Thanks for this.
I did. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, that's Tim Leeper. When are you back next? Do you know?
We don't know. Pan Am Games, we're getting ready to go. We start Sunday there. We try to defend. We try to become the three-time champion of the Pan Am Games in Denton, Lima, starting, I think, about 2 weeks from now. So that should be a lot of fun, and looking forward to doing that for sure. It's always great to get together with the Canadian guys. It's great to compete. Pan Am Games is such a wonderful event. Obviously, we hosted here last time, and I'm sure people enjoyed it, but it's going to be good to get back on the field and compete again.
All right, best of luck. We'll be watching for sure. That's Tim Leeper. My name is George Rusick. Blue Jays baseball in this place tomorrow. I'll be back Friday with Justin Bourne for another edition of a good show. Primetime Sports straight ahead with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Talk to you Friday. Bye.